We wanted to thank two unique bicycle manufacturers for joining us today. Marcus Hayes, who's the founder of PI Mobility, has his electrically powered bicycle in the foyer area here. Bo Rogers has the electrically powered bicycle in the foyer. And Bo is with Second River, ELV Motors and Second River. Marcus Hayes has the streamlined red bicycle with a different kind of form in the foyer for you to look at from PI Mobility. Thank you for being here. And of course, because you are, this information will go to Chair Oberstar, and you'll be recognized at the national and at the state level for your attendance. I think that concludes the general comments. We'll proceed now into the element of this proceedings, which are very, very important for the information we're going to be sending to Washington. Again, let me stress that we're looking towards the future. What's happened in the past isn't useful anymore. We're looking for ways of accommodating, as Carl mentioned, ways of accommodating more bicyclists on the mass transportation vehicles while not inconveniencing the current transit riders and future transit riders. That's quite a dilemma right now with reduced revenue for our various local transportation and community programs. But that's our task, and we're enjoined to do that by the leaders of the national transportation programs, and so it's our job to come up with solutions. I'd like to introduce now Gary Richards, Mr. Roadshow from the Mercury and News. He has the most popular column in the Mercury and News in any paper in the region. He is a professor in the San Jose State University Mineta Transportation Institute Master of Science in Transportation Management program, and he is a remarkable individual. His bio is in the material that was passed out to you as you came in the door, so I'm not going to go into much more detail there. But Gary is the boss now, and thank you very much for sharing your time with us. Mr. Roadshow.
Thank you very much, and thanks for asking me to be the moderator. Before I introduce the panel, and I'm going to go for reverse order because Kevin will be the last person I introduce, and he'll be the first panelist. Santa Clara County is in the process right now of almost $30 million in bicycle pedestrian improvements. And I think it's even more significant than the dollar amount. The dollar amount overall is like one interchange on a highway, so it pales in comparison. But the Mary Avenue bicycle pedestrian bridge over Interstate 280, drive 280 some nighttime at night, it is all lit up, and it's an expensive bicycle improvement. However, I think from what I'm hearing from readers, it has such enormous potential because people are noticing it. There are other two bicycle bridges, one over 101 and 237, and I'm starting to hear from readers who are in two different groups that I didn't hear very much from. And one group is the person who wants to go out, their husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, and they want to bicycle on the weekend. They want to go out for recreation. They see this bridge. Hey, I can go north to south now. And the other is the person who's driven to work forever, and he's now thinking about maybe I can commute to work by bicycle. And I'm hearing more and more, and I think the improvements that are out there is kind of ringing a bell in their head that, hey, this may be possible. And I bug Yves Zudi from the city of San Jose and John Brazil about when's this bicycle lane going to open up, and because those are what the readers want to know. And we also get into what Carl talked about is protocol on the road. If you see one bicyclist blow a red light, they think all bicyclists blow a red light. Well, that's not true, but trying to combat that and teach car drivers how to make a right turn when there's a bicyclist in that bicycle lane. Because that is the one issue that bicyclists complain about most often with a lot of validity. Our panelists will talk, and we'll go through the list, and they'll speak no more than 15 minutes, and what we want to do is get down then, open up for questions, because you know that's what I do is answering questions, and I think the questions from you are the most fascinating thing about my job, and I think the most fascinating thing that we can learn as panelists. To my right, Mark Simon. Mark is a former reporter with the Chronicle, Palo Alto Times, now works with San Mateo Transit District, Caltrain, and so he's gone over into a real job after leaving journalism. Second is John Brazil will be the next speaker, or in reverse order. John is, I call him the bicycle guru for the city of San Jose. When I have a question, that's the man I go to, and he's been head of the bicycle pedestrian program since, I believe, 2001, John. And Corinne Winter, Carl talked about her, executive director of the Silicon Valley Bicycle Coalition. I like what Carl had to say, taking a sleepy organization, making it proactive, and was a big help when I was writing stories on the 280 Mary Avenue and the other bridges. Dr. Shirley Johnson, the San Francisco Cycling Commuter of the Year, and went to Holland a number of years ago and became an avid bicycling thing. If I read your bio right, you bicycled from Alaska down to San Francisco? Now, that's a commute. Alex Smith, Alex with the Federal Transit Administration. Sean Cole with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. And our first panelist will be Dr. Kevin Krizak. Kevin is from the University of Colorado. If you've been to Boulder, you know how many bicycles are on the road up there. Sometimes even the snow is a story. Kevin is very interested in where people live and how that affects their commute patterns. And we're seeing more of that in the South Bay as more high-rise areas go up, bicycle lanes on First Street with development. And so our first panelist, Kevin.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's an absolute pleasure to be here this morning sharing perspectives, mainly from the national level here, but I've now lived in Boulder for 16 months, having lived in Minneapolis for 6 years previous to that. So there's a lot of experience to draw from. The experience primarily is as an avid cyclist, as an avid cyclist commuter, but also as one very active in the research arena in the academy, trying to weave together various strands of thought to come up with a cohesive story and about how and where advocacy can learn from academia and how academia can learn from advocacy, really, to forge this partnership. At the outset, though, I'd like to send kudos to the Mineta Transportation Center for initiating a study which I'm the principal investigator of, analyzing bicycle access and egress issues to transit. And so realizing that this is an important issue, an understudied issue, and for the Mineta Transportation Institute to formidably promote such an analysis, I think, speaks a lot to the resources that you have. So what we're here primarily to talk about, the first and last mile, we have to realize is our gathering this morning is a reaction to a good thing. It's a good thing that's happening. And in many respects, we're a victim of our own success. That's because transit companies, the operators, are now speaking out because their timetables are being violated because there's too many damn bikes on transit agencies, right? And so the bicyclists are getting frustrated because there's no more room available. So 5 years ago, this is a wonderful problem that we were striving for, right? 10 years ago. And most metropolitan areas failed to have buses that actually had one, much less two bike racks. Well, now it's standard practice for all buses in most metropolitan areas to have two bike racks, but that's not enough supply. So this is a good thing. This is a good problem that we're trying to address here. And so we all should be congratulated for that, including the cyclists and the transit operators. Now we're stuck in that issue of how to take it to the next generation. That next generation of integrating cycling and transit is something that's a little bit more sticky. But it's entirely consistent with the momentum of that I've noticed over the past few months. That is more than a general uptick in the level of and activity of cycling-related endeavors. So we now have a U.S. president who, while not a cyclist, admittedly not a cyclist, has self-proclaimed to the cycling advocacy organizations that he'll do whatever he needs to do take photographs, ride a bike, if they need him to be photographed as such. Last week, the National Organization for Advocacy, Bike Advocacy, Bikes Belong, or last month, gathered a dozen researchers in Boulder, Colorado, for the first time ever, to try and figure out how bicycling-related research could better parlay into advocacy-related efforts and policy. This is the first time that a national advocacy organization gathered together 12 university researchers in one location for a day and a half to brainstorm about these related issues. We're seeing bicycling increasingly in advertisements, in cartoons, in TV, and film. All you have to do is just open up any magazine or watch television, and you'll see it. There's more bikes in the movies. There's more bikes in the backdrops. There's more bikes in art these days. All you have to do is walk down the street here. You see the bike culture exhibit at the San Jose City Hall that's currently on display. Again, another testament. And one that I'd like to point to is that many of us recognize David Byrne, formerly of the Talking Heads, as one of the country's most avant-garde musicians and artists out there. Well, we now have David Byrne penning his thoughts in the New York Times about bicycling-related parking facilities and bicycling fashion. I mean, if anyone has picked up the New York Times over the past 4 or 5 months, you'll see that the Sunday fashion articles are columns by David Byrne about how to look cool in Manhattan riding a bike. I mean, I think that we're at a turning point. Now, we like to hope that this excitement is more than a flash in the pan, and I think that it is, as someone who's followed these trends for some time now. And while the cycling community needs to celebrate increased investment and devotion to cycling, we need deliberate and measured approaches to maximizing the return on investment for the limited resources that are available. So we need to direct those limited resources efficiently and productively, and that's what the study that I'm the principal investigator on is funded by the Mineta Transportation Institute, which is primarily why I'm here talking to you this morning, is aimed to do, is to look at that combination of bicycling and transit and realize that the way we've been doing in the past may not be the best way to be doing in the future, and so what are the most cost-effective ways to be pursuing this? So primary among the reasons that we gather here is that there exists considerable room for the bicycle to realize its environmental, its health, and congestion benefits when it's increasingly integrated with transit services. So a successful marriage between the two, bicycling and transit, will result in increasing, first, the catchment area and subsequent patronage of transit. B, or number two, the efficiency of transit by reducing the necessity of feeder bus services. And number three, the demand, increasing the overall demand for cycling. So a core problem, however, exists that the predominant approach for integrating these modes, bikes aboard transit vehicles, runs up against capacity constraints. Because the predominant approach employed to date involves transporting bicycles, aboard the transit vehicle. So, which considerably, with widespread use, two bikes on a bus, sometimes three, which we're now pushing the envelope on in many transit agencies. And a further limiting factor revolves around the limited constraint of the transit vehicle along the trunk portion of the trip. So while we could be adjusting the capacity of bikes in transit at the margins through incentives, you know, will you get off now so that this additional bike can get on, exploiting technology, okay, when are you going to get on, when are you going to get off, and trying to match that with some sort of queuing system, the opportunity is ripe to consider broader solutions. And so these broader solutions would look something along the following lines. We first have the option where we could rely on the standard practice of transporting the owner's bicycle either inside the vehicle or outside the vehicle on the transit vehicle. The second is using the owner's bicycle and parking it at the transit access location, and then walking from the egress location, or walking to the access location, and then using transit and bike at the egress location. at the get-off spot, okay? Now, these second and third options require increasing investment around transit facilities, approximately a mile or two in length, with respect to striped lanes, parking, et cetera, et cetera. The third, however, and this is one that is terribly understudied and unexploited, requires us to think more broadly about public bike sharing systems, okay? So sharing a bicycle, which would be primarily based at the transit access point, or sharing a bicycle, which would be primarily based at the transit egress point. Now, anyone that has been following this for the past X number of months, you know that, again, there's more than a general uptick in public bicycle-related, public bike sharing systems, all right? So we read about the systems in Paris, we read about the systems in Lyon. The jury's still out on these. Any self-respecting city worth their weight in salt in the U.S. right now, largely in response to the Democratic and Republican national conventions in Denver and Minneapolis this past year, in which I believe either 1,000 or 2,000 bicycles were available at each of these locations, saw the wonderful success that these public bike sharing systems reaped in terms of transporting the delegates and whatnot. Now, both of these cities, Minneapolis and Denver, are on the cusp, as any other city, North American city, worth their weight in salt, are considering public bike sharing systems as well. Now, none of them have really played out yet, nor do we know the formula, do we know the protocol, do we know the pattern that we need to follow for these different types of systems to be successful. Heck, we don't really even know if the ones in Lyon and in Paris are successful yet. But what we do know is that there's more than a considerable enthusiasm towards trying to figure out the patterns of success about these types of systems and reaping, delving into that knowledge, harvesting it for bicycling and transit is an important opportunity for investigation. So there's burgeoning work examining the characteristics of costs of bicycle sharing systems, and such information would directly feed into this research as well. But the outstanding question here is, given a variety of urban form settings, sometimes we have bike lanes, sometimes we don't, sometimes we have high density, sometimes we don't, sometimes we have high density but without a population of bicycle commuters, sometimes we have low density with a active population of bicycle commuters. What are the variety of urban form contexts, and what are the costs of feasible alternatives, which provides the most effective solution to this issue? So the Federal Highway Administration reports that over one half of U.S. residents live less than 2 miles from the closest public transportation route. That suggests that there might be more than a compelling market out there for people to be riding their bikes to transit. Now, which of this market should we be maximizing our investment in, suggesting a sizable market to be targeting bicycling and transit? So what is the potential to possibly seize this market? Doing so really requires us to put our hat on as a psychologist and think about what are the various issues. I mean, many respects, we're preaching to the choir here. But what are the different types of issues that cyclists have to overcome in order to make that trip, all right? So we have initial considerations. Do I need to pick the kid up from daycare? Do I feel groggy this morning? Is it raining outside? Et cetera, et cetera. If any one of those are possibly a yes, you know as well as I do that the likelihood of riding a bike is going to be less. Then we have trip barriers, okay? So how is it? Is there a lot of traffic on the trip? Is there a pinch point, a particular bridge that we have to cross? All there needs to be is just one intersection that we have to cross, and that may be threatening for many what we call type B or type C cyclists. And so removing those different types of trip barriers, bicycling and transit being one of them, is an important thing. And then there's destination barriers. And these are exactly the types of things that Carl was talking about. The destination where, providing a supportive environment at the employer site or any other site through parking or increased morale or whatnot. And The thing is that bicycling transit really integrates from a psychological perspective on both of these latter two stages, the trip barriers as well as the destination barriers. And only after each one of these three criteria are satisfied do we have a successful outcome, that is, a bicycle commuter, right? And so it requires us to think diligently about this, which is one of the reasons why, as part of this research, we're going to be conducting focus groups and case studies in a variety of handful of different types of settings to glean from either avid cyclists or those cyclists that are kind of more on the edge of not doing so on a regular pattern about the different types of issues that need to be overcome and inform the possibilities. So in the end, there are these different types of alternatives, and we want to inform this. We want to inform these, and this is what this research is going to be headed towards, analyzing the cost effectiveness. Each of these alternatives carry a different cost, convenience, infrastructure, and benefit considerations, and these issues are complicated by the variety and types of users, their frequency, and the variety of urban form characteristics. Now, so in the end, and hopefully according to what I gleaned from Donna and Karen, we will be doing this approximately in 1 year's time, and we'll be able to share some of the results of this research in collaboration with Peter Haas at the Mineta Transportation Institute. And the users will be able to benefit from those seeking guidance on the most cost-effective strategies to maximize bicycling transit integration, guidance which will likely reject a, quote, one-size-fits-all approach. And ultimately, we will be able to advise transit agencies with informed suggestions about how they can maintain and improve returns on their investments by overcoming rack capacity limitations and more effectively integrating bicycling and transit. I have a lot more to say. We can certainly mention at the Q&A about other related dimensions, perspectives of cycling-related endeavors. But at this point, I want to thank you very much for the invitation to come to San Jose this morning, your time this morning, and your attention. Thank you.
Our next speaker will be Sean Cole. Sean's with the Metropolitan Transportation Commission. He'll be able to offer a Bay Area-wide view. He also bicycles, is it 18 miles round trip a day? A few weeks ago, I asked various transportation planners in the Valley how they commute to work. And I'm thinking I drive solo every single day. I did admittedly set the bar low because I said, one day a week, do you do some other way of getting into work? Because that's what we always hear as commuters, if you could do something else one day a week. And a vast majority exceeded that. So I was encouraged by that, but to be honest with you, it wasn't the story I expected, and the poster boy here is Sean.
Thanks, Gary. Well, one of the reasons that we're here today is to talk about bicycle as a legitimate mode of access to transit. So, this isn't really a fringe activity. I mean, it's sort of seen as that, and it is an efficient, convenient way to get to transit. But we sort of lack some of the data to make that case. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about problems with the data, which is good follow-up from what Kevin was saying. So one reason for this is there's an undercount of cyclists in general from the sources of data which we get our numbers from, and that's the census data. And then we also have in the Bay Area, Bay Area Travel Survey, which is basically asked people where they went, what type of trip did they make. And the reason for that is because the data that's out there is really asking people, how did you get to work last week? So, it's about 1.5% of people that ride to work. Well, in the Bay Area, work trips are only about 1/4 of all trips in general. So you're disregarding this whole host of other trips that people make. And, we talk about recreation trips versus commute trips, but we really don't make that distinction when we talk about car trips, when there's a lot of congestion going down 880 towards the Coliseum in Oakland if there's a football game. That's all due to recreation-type trips. But we do make that distinction for bike trips. In the Bay Area, there's about 81,000 home-to-work trips, but there's the second highest category is about 75,000 trips per day of shopping trips. So while work is pretty important, a lot of people are using their bike to get around shopping, and also school isn't included in there. The difficulty with bikes to transit is that it's difficult to quantify. So the trip, since the data that we collect is self-reported, it can be counted as a transit or a bike trip. So, for example, this morning I took my bike in the rain and rode it to the BART station and got on board. And, you know, had I been answering the question from the census data, I could have either said I had got to work this morning by bike or by transit. And when I leave, I intend to ride my bike all the way home. So, you know, it's sort of up to the person making that trip. And you know, that undercount isn't, you know, for the person making that trip, it's sort of just seen as, you know, that's just what I do. That's how I get to work. You know, you can walk to transit, count that as a walk trip. You can count that as a transit trip as well. So that sort of stuff isn't really tracked in the census data or in our travel data as well. Transit operators in the Bay Area do try to keep track of this. They do special studies. They try to track mode of access to transit. They don't really say where they're coming from, but they do say, how did you get there? They use different methodology. They don't really do it at regular intervals, so it's kind of hard to track how people are getting to transit and by what mode. Also in the Bay Area, we have 27 transit operators, so with every kind of mode, and it's hard for them to sort of, you know, for me to sort of look at and say, well, what's this mode of access people are doing? Are they driving and parking? Are they taking their bike, walking to transit? But bicycling is growing. As Kevin mentioned, there's quite a bit of evidence, and you can just sort of see that in your day-to-day activities, even if you ride or drive a car, that there are more people riding their bikes just in general. So, for example, Bike to Work Day this year, which was just last month, it was up 36% over previous years, and then in 2007, it was up even higher from 2006. So a lot of people are riding their bikes. You know, some people have said high gas prices. That's in Gary's column. People have said that gas prices has forced them to look at different ways to get to work. And there's been growth on bicycles on transit. Of course, Caltrain has had some challenges accommodating all the bikes. Other operators in the Bay Area, BART, for example, is you'll see a bike on board pretty much every trip that you can take. So, you know, why is this sort of important? Well, it's, you know, in addition to keeping track of transit trips and bike trips, you know, we're often asked, well, what is the effect of providing infrastructure or better access on transit? Like, what does that get you in terms of the trip? Well, we do know that if you build it, they will come. The city of Portland has kind of tracked this pretty well over the last few years, and there's one particular chart that all bike advocates and transportation researchers sort of overuse, but it's effective nonetheless, and that's tracking bikeways versus the number of bridge crossings on a particular bridge within the city. And just to give an example, in 1992, they had 83 miles of bikeways and about 2,800 crossings on the bridge. In 2005, they had 259 miles of bikeways and about 10,000 crossings. So there's definitely a case to be made that the infrastructure does affect the bike trip. Whether that's cause and effect or rerouting or whatever, we don't really know. But at the end of the day, there are more people riding. So sort of that to that end, I've been working with bicycle advocacy groups, UC Berkeley, Alta Consulting, on this national documentation project. It's a national bicycle and pedestrian count project, which has sort of come up with a methodology that will allow regions and all across the U.S. to really compare counts by collecting data in a specific way. So that's by either counting crossing a specific point or counting the number of bikes or pedestrians at an intersection. So we had done this kind of back in 2002, 2003, and we didn't really know, I think, what we intended to do with this data, but we had identified 100 locations in each of the nine Bay Area counties, and we had said we're going to count there every year. We've stopped doing that, but there's been a big interest in it in this year, and there's going to be a lot of people collecting data. So at the end of 2009, I hope to have some sort of numbers that we can look at, and then in future years, perhaps we can hire a consultant to sort of track this like we do our other modes of transportation, transit and highways. So that's sort of the data aspect on it. I wanted to talk a little bit about the complete streets policies, because it's really about not just planning for one mode. It's about planning for access, and there's some policies that are sort of new that have got agencies to sort of think about that, and to get people used to thinking about moving people instead of cars or just trains. In 2006, MTC had a routine accommodations policy, which is a complete streets policy. That's to consider bicycles and pedestrians in all project planning and design. And the way that's done is there's a checklist which project sponsors are required to complete, which is about 10 questions that sort of ask the current conditions and asks if bikes or pedestrians are being thought of in this project, and if they have not been, then what are the reasons for that? And so that policy, even though it's been in place, was just recently applied to the new American Recovery Reinvestment Act, the stimulus projects for their local streets and roads. And so there were some limitations because of the money, the way it came from the federal government, but it was, we got all the project sponsors to fill it out, and I think it was really helpful. I think it helped people sort of look that, while the fund source is a local streets and roads project and it's road rehabilitation, that bike projects and road projects are not mutually exclusive. If you have a complete streets policy, they include everybody, and you're talking about funding the roadway and not funding a specific mode of travel. So in addition, in 2008, the California Complete Streets Act was passed, which is pretty new. And that's city and county general plans should accommodate all road users. So it's a new shift in thinking for agencies around the state that really, getting them to think more of just the car travel. Caltrans also has a complete streets policy, which is called Deputy Directive 64. That was revised along with the California Complete Streets Act, and they strengthened it up and sort of changed a bunch of shoulds to shalls within the department. So, it's new for Caltrans too. They sort of have the era of the road building agency, and they're trying to think of, transit and bicycles and pedestrians as well. I wanted to add that what we're doing as an agency, we have a transit connectivity study, which we've identified 24 different transit hubs, and that's wayfinding and real-time transit information and schedules. And so that's the information piece, because there's not just the infrastructure portion of it, but how people can sort of find their way to transit. That also will address the last mile issues, and they're still working on that right now, so there's not that much to report. And in addition, we've had for a few years now a Safe Routes to Transit program, which the call for projects just went out just this week, which is about $4 million every other year for the next 5 years, and that's specifically to fund bike and ped projects that go to transit stations, to transit hubs, and it's to take sort of some of the traffic off the bridges in the Bay Area, which is the because it's funded by Regional Measure 2, which is to sort of relieve congestion. But it's sort of, you know, we've had safe routes to school for a while, and the safe routes to transit is kind of a new way of thinking, you know, and trying to address that last mile issues. So with that, thank you very much.
Our next panel member is Alex Smith with the Federal Transit Administration, DOT. We have a champion here. Alex is the only male to be honored as the National Collegiate Mountain Bike and Road Champion. He did one in 1994 and got the other award in 2001.
I was probably one of the few people to be in school that long, so that was an advantage for me. One question I have for us in this room is, can we make a difference? You know, there's a lot of empty buses driving around. I work for the Federal Transit Administration. Excuse me, I also have a little bit of a cold. But, you know, what do we do when we see all these empty buses driving around or empty bike lanes? You know, is this just a bunch of bureaucratic speak, or does this actually translate into results? Well, in Los Angeles, the rapid bus program there, the has seen about 30% increase in ridership. And that's sort of, if I'm in charge, I look to something like that, a model for success. In Curitiba, Brazil, you know, that's how that inspired Los Angeles to make those changes. And they didn't have a lot of money. And they said, how can we make a big difference with this, get the most bang for the buck? And you know, I challenge transit agencies to think in that way. How can we get the most bang for the buck? Where's the low-hanging fruit, so to speak? And I've been with FTA since 2002, and when I think of this problem, I think the way to bump up the ridership and get the most results for the least amount of money is by providing better bike access to transit. And how can we do that? There's public-private partnerships with these bike stations, and Warm Planet in the Bay Area is a good example, I think, because the problem is, by their nature, high-capacity transit lines like bus rapid transit, light rail transit, muni metro, heavy rail like Caltrain and BART, these services are too expensive and too big to have a very wide network. So we have a few major lines. How can we get to those lines? The choices for accessing these thick lines is by neighborhood bus. I prefer the term neighborhood bus. Feeder bus turns us all into feed, so that's not such a good solution. Walking. Walking's fine. While necessary for the mobility impaired, neighborhood buses are often slow and expensive for agencies to operate. So I do recognize they perform a critical function, but they're not necessarily the only or the best solution in all cases. And while environmentally favorable and inexpensive, walking is slow. So, people don't like to walk more than a quarter of a mile. So that's a bit of a problem there. When we can't get BART or Caltrain a quarter mile to everybody's house, even if it's pretty high density. While fast, driving is impactful and expensive. It's especially so when you consider the cost of parking to the driver, the cost of parking to agencies. You know, it usually falls within the requirements of a transit operator to provide a parking garage, and FTA funds parking garages. I don't think they should, but it's not. I guess I shouldn't get on the record as saying that. But and they're also expensive to the community. Parking garages, provide a lot of traffic in and out, create hot spots for CO2 emissions, etc. Biking, however, is inexpensive, fast, and environmentally favorable. Again, it's not for everybody, but for an increasing number, it is a good solution. And we're not looking for, you know, 50% mode split out of the bike, but if we can get anywhere close to 10%, we'd be pretty happy. But in most places, some places we have UC Davis 70% mode split, so it can get pretty high. Why don't more people take their bike to transit? Generally, bike parking is often not secure, and sometimes needed services are not provided. We've heard talk of showers, locker room facilities, etc. Additionally, bike commuters are discouraged on transit because they cannot take their bike with them on board high-capacity services. And Dr. Shirley Johnson will touch on that next in greater detail, using Caltrain as an example. But what solutions can we find to overcome the main obstacles with security and amenities? So again, what was my silver bullet here if I'm thinking as a transit agency? One option is the attended staffed bike parking. In these arrangements, members pay often monthly or annual dues for services that function like a coat check. So I ride my bike to the station, pick up a ticket, and then drop off the ticket and exchange it for the bike at the end of the day. This has a lot of advantages. You have somebody watching over your bike all day. It's pretty safe and secure. The transit agencies get a tenant to rent a space while the riders get a service. Staff that work there can accommodate all kinds of bike configurations, large bikes, small bikes, three-wheeled bikes or funky bikes or tandems, whatnot. And staff can provide extra services like bike repair, maps, and visitor information. A disadvantage of these staffed facilities is that they can be quite expensive to pay for the operating cost of the attendant. Another option, thinking about a station like BART or Caltrain, or even a future bus rapid transit facility, would be unattended bike parking. And this is actually within the trademark name of bike station, is actually the highest growth sector. In this scenario, members would gain access to a room with a key, a code, or a proximity key. And stations typically have a video security, and they may have showers, restrooms, lockers, and a bike workshop area. Other vending or retail services may also be offered. And these have lower cost, and there is a trade-off with a little less security also. For both the people and their bikes. A third option is automated bike parking. I haven't actually seen this in America, but in Japan, they have giant machines that you park a bike in and it flies up. And this approach can handle huge numbers of bikes very quickly with low staff support. But the disadvantage of this approach is it's very expensive to start up. And only makes sense when you have a huge number of bikes. So we should be so lucky someday to be able to pay for such a machine, but at this point it's not feasible. A fourth option is to provide incentives for transit agencies to accommodate bikes on board transit vehicles. Because when you have a station, whether it's attended or not, it presupposes that you can ride to the station, get on the train, and then walk at the other end. That's not always feasible. Sometimes you need to ride to the station, take the bike on, and then ride at the other end. So it depends how far your origin is from the transit line and how far your destination is from the transit line. In the cases where you have to take the bike with you, there's another reason, which is, let's say you have a even if you could walk at one end, you want to do a trip in the middle, trip chaining. You have to stop and get a haircut like halfway down. You want your bike on the transit system. And that, again, Shirley Johnson will talk about more about that. But that's an important part of this whole equation because the stations will not accommodate a big chunk of people's trip-making purposes. A fifth option is to provide commuters with the same incentives as transit commuters. Many of us who work for public and sometimes private agencies will get commuter benefits to take transit, whereas only recently there's been a tax break for bike commuters. But similar to Don Shoup's parking cash out, which made it possible to get cash in lieu of a parking subsidy, perhaps there's a way to get bike cash out where if you're not taking the bus, you can get the same equivalent money for riding your bike. It'd be complicated because it's hard to verify that someone might expend the bikes on bike commuting rather than just keeping the money and taking their car. If we settle upon one of these options, how can we secure the funding needed to bring it about? Currently, FTA provides 90% of the capital to local agencies and transit providers to install bicycle facilities, and up to 95% for bicycle-related transit enhancement projects. So FTA and FHWA do not provide funds directly to anybody who might want to operate these or implement these ideas. It would have to be a transit agency or local municipality. But they do offer a higher rate, you know, 90 to 95% than they do for other types of projects. One important attribute of the federal funding for bicycle and pedestrian facilities is flexibility. According to FHWA guidance, virtually all the major funding programs can be used for bicycle and pedestrian-related projects. So I think all too often local agencies with a knee-jerk response go to the TE, Transit Enhancements Program, but there are dozens, well, maybe not dozens. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, but there's 15 or 16 different funding programs, and most of them are eligible for bicycle and pedestrian programs. CMAQ and STP are often very appropriate. And just to give you a quick scan of all the different programs that can be used for bicycle funding, I'll just, including all federal sources, I'll just give you an idea. The National Highway System Program, Surface Transportation Program, Highway Safety Improvement Program, Safe Routes to School Program, Transportation Enhancements Activities, Congestion Mitigation Air Quality, that's CMAQ, Federal Lands Highway Program, Scenic Byways, Bridge, State and Community Traffic Safety Program, Job Access and Reverse Commute, Recreational Trails, there's a few more, but you get the idea. There's a lot of different pots of money out there, and I have more information, you know, but again, I wouldn't just try to apply through me. You have to go through your agency, and they probably have this information already. If they don't, then in your agency, see me. When bicycle and pedestrian projects are eligible, there are some eligibility issues to keep an eye out for. Transportation purpose has already come up. The purpose of bicycle facilities shall be transportation, not recreation. And I believe this is a little bit of a shaky distinction. The distinction doesn't exist for pedestrians or automobiles, and I don't think it should exist for bicycles. But I think some people are afraid of funding swervy little routes in a grassy field somewhere. But I don't think they should be. They have access to ballparks, national parks for cars. All these are highway eligible. But that's the way it's written now. Non-construction activities generally are not eligible for most programs, although there are some, including STP, TE, and CMAQ. So generally, federal funds are for construction, although there are some exceptions. And there are some federal funding requirements that are streamlined for bicycle projects. According to FHWA guidance, it makes no sense for activities such as crosswalk striping, bicycle parking installation, and bike lane marking, which usually require no additional right-of-way and cause no environmental impact, to have the same approval process as multi-lane highway construction project. The construction of bicycle facilities is normally exempt from having to complete a project-specific NEPA review. I just threw that in because I know that's at issue now in San Francisco with the current bicycle master plan. In conclusion, there's a lot we can do now to increase ridership of high-capacity transit. I pointed out that I believe what I believe to be the low-hanging fruit, the best opportunities to access these systems, I think, are attended and unattended bike parking facilities. And I've also outlined currently available funding mechanisms that are probably underutilized and not fully understood. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. I have a 17-year-old son who's had his driver's license for 1 year. And while he's in school, I pay for the gas. Well, he's working this summer. So I said, you get to pay for the gasoline. His job is at a local veterinarian about 2 miles away. And I said, you know, one way you can save on gas costs, bicycle to work. He loves bicycling. He's not convinced yet, but he's thinking about it. And it's that price of gasoline. And there is a direct correlation. Our next speaker is Shirley Johnson. Shirley moved to Holland in, was it 1987?
Yes.
And fell in love with bicycling and learned, I think it's the way of life over there, and is the founder of Bikes on Board. It's perhaps a great success for Caltrain and a great problem for Caltrain. And Shirley will talk about it.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank the organizers very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. There is a handout that has a slide deck. Unfortunately, we're not able to project here, but I would encourage you to pull that handout. It's called Bike Plus Train, A Perfect Combination. And all the work I'm going to be presenting today is from the Bikes on Board project, which is sponsored by the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. So what I'm going to talk about first is access to public transit and the benefit of bicycling, and we've heard that a bit already. And then I want to move into a case study, and that is Caltrain's onboard bicycle service. I want to talk about how Bikes on Board has been working with Caltrain to improve that service, including investigating some of Caltrain's concerns about that service. And then I want to go into Caltrain's progress before I close to emphasize that bike plus train really is a perfect combination. The Metropolitan Transportation Commission has done a study in the Bay Area, and they found that people living within half mile of a transit station are 3 times more likely to take transit. Now, for a lot of people, it's the time to transit that's important. In 10 minutes, a person can walk about half a mile. But in 10 minutes, that same person can bike 2 miles. So what that does is increase the accessibility by 16-fold to a transit station. Access to public transit is really important. The average bike commuter can ride about 3 miles. It will ride about 3 miles, I should say. There have been studies to show that. A lot of people don't live within 3 miles of work, but a lot of people live within 3 miles of a transit station. So combining the bike plus train considerably extends the travel range and enables people to commute to work by bike, which is what I do every day. I bring my bike to the station, as do many, many other cyclists. We bring our bikes on board for a fast trip of many miles, and then we bike to our destination. Caltrain is a national leader in the Bikes on Board service. They are able to green the first and the last mile by bringing a bike on board the train. And I'd like to look at Caltrain as a good case study, again, being a national leader. Caltrain's Bikes on Board service is enormously popular. It offers convenience and flexibility rivaling the automobile. In fact, 40% of cyclists vary their normal commute pattern. Caltrain did a study, 2007 online bike survey, and they found that the biggest reason, the number one reason cyclists bring their bike on board is that flexibility. Now, with my bike on board, I can get off at a number of different stations and arrive at the same destination. This is particularly helpful today because Caltrain service for some stations is once an hour. But by using adjacent stations, we can take trains 5 times an hour. So it's very, very useful to have our bike on board. Particularly suburban stations have limited public access. A bicycle, having your bike with you, that's no problem. We can just jump off the train and ride to our destination. It's door to door, and it's often faster than the available public transportation when there is public transportation. And of course, it's a green commute method. 60% of cyclists who ride Caltrain cited environmental concerns as a reason they bring their bikes on board. And we all know biking is fun and great exercise. We really love it, and we love Caltrain's Bikes on Board service. In fact, over 7% of Caltrain's passengers bring a bike on board today. Now, what may have started years ago as perhaps what some people thought was a novelty has become a true, practical, viable commute method for those of us who ride our bikes to work every day using Caltrain's onboard bike service. It's a fabulous system, and I think some people didn't expect it to have quite the success that it does today. With that success comes some challenges. This is a photograph of cyclists who were denied boarding, something we call bumped, because there wasn't enough space on the train for their bikes. Now, these cyclists all have paid tickets because Caltrain is a proof of payment system. The conductor stands in the doorway, as you see, and does not let the cyclist board. The most frustrating part about this is watching that train pull away with empty seats. Caltrain's 2009 annual passenger count showed that every train ran the entire line with empty seats. Cyclists are being bumped every day. This is correspondence from the Caltrain board meeting, and it's full of emails from cyclists who are reporting being bumped. Excuse me. Cyclists are exceeding capacity on the train, and this graph is also in your handout. What it shows is weekday bike boardings on the y-axis and year on the x-axis. And what we see is that bicycle boardings were increasing rapidly until 2006 when routine bumping began. Now, we would have expected bicycle boardings to continue to increase, but in fact, they flattened out. The chart underneath shows that from 2003 to 2006, walk-on passengers increased 16%, and bicycle passengers increased 41%. 2006 to 2008, walk-ons increased another 16%. So we would have logically expected that bicycle boardings would increase another 16%. Unfortunately, they increased only 5% because of the limited bike space on trains. The sad part about this is 2008 fare box revenue loss for Caltrain is about $1 million. And the real tragedy is Caltrain has a public hearing tomorrow to declare a fiscal emergency. But there is a bright side. Caltrain has opened a new market. 80% of cyclists rarely, if ever, ride Caltrain if they don't bring their bike on board. So this is a brand new market that Caltrain has opened up. These are people who normally would not ride the train. So there's a fantastic opportunity here. The question is how to resolve this issue. This is the bike car in a train leaving San Francisco. So this train has not even left the first station, and this bike car is completely full. What that means is any cyclist down the line doesn't have a chance of getting on until somebody gets off. This is that very same train before it leaves San Francisco, and what you see is it has many, many empty seats. The issue is a mismatched demand. There's not enough bike space and too many empty seats. The obvious solution is to add bike capacity by removing these empty seats. Now, of course, we'd all like to add more train cars, add more bike cars, but there are operational and budgetary constraints that prohibit that. So we formed the Bikes on Board Project. It's sponsored by the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, and it consists of cyclists from all three counties that Caltrain serves. We set two goals. Number one, increase bike capacity on board Caltrain's existing trains by 2009. And number two, ensure recommendations for Caltrain's new rolling stock for electrification in 2015 meet bicyclist needs. In scope for the Bikes on Board Project is bikes on trains now and bikes on trains in the future. Out of scope is bike access to stations and bike security at stations. The reason these are out of scope for us is because Caltrain wrote an excellent bicycle access and parking plan, so they've got that covered. They've done that very, very well. We don't want to diminish the importance of that. It works for some people. But only 1% of Caltrain passengers actually park their bike at the station. The vast majority bring their bikes on board the train. That's the real benefit of the service, and so that's what Bikes on Board focuses on. Now, Caltrain does have some legitimate concerns about its onboard bicycle program. The first is dwell time. There's the concern that cyclists take longer to board and may cause dwell time delays, how long the train stops at the station. The second concern was seat removal. If you take out seats, there's a possibility you could lose ridership. And the third concern is subsidies, because a bicycle does take the space of one seat on the train. So I would direct you to slide 11 in your handout, and this is a graph taken directly from Caltrain's 2007 progress report, and it shows on the y-axis on-time performance, and on the x-axis it shows year. If you would look between 2003 and 2007, you'll see that on-time performance was very good. It varied around 95%, hovered around 95%, which is Caltrain's target. In that same time period, bicycle boardings increased 43%. So the data just does not support that bicycles cause dwell time delays. Now, Caltrain has an operational policy that bicyclists must board last. When bicyclists board last, a bicyclist is the last one on the train. So the perception could be, if there is a delay, no matter who caused it, the perception could be that the bicyclist caused it. So we recommend to Caltrain that they allow bicyclist priority boarding at the bike car, because then walk-on passengers can go to other cars, distribute the boarding among cars, and that will reduce the dwell time. The next concern Caltrain had was seat removal and the loss of potential ridership. Caltrain did an excellent, though inadvertent, experimental trial on seat removal. On May 30th, Caltrain removed 14 cars from service for emergency repairs. The result is a lower seating capacity on board the trains. Interestingly, ridership actually increased from 5% from May to June, even though those cars were out of service, and no walk-on passengers were bumped. In your handout on slide 13, there is a graph of that inadvertent experimental trial, and this shows average weekday riders on the y-axis and month in 2008 on the x-axis. And what you'll see is the typical pattern that Caltrain sees, that is, ridership increases through the summer months and then drops back down through the winter months. And what we see is that trend in ridership increase is uninterrupted between May and June, even though in June there were far fewer seats on the train. So the conclusion's pretty obvious. If you take out empty seats, it does not impact ridership. Estimated subsidies are shown on the next slide, 14. And the concern here, of course, is that all passengers are subsidized. In Caltrain's case, farebox revenue covers about 40% of operating costs. All passengers being subsidized, if you look at this chart, it shows that anyone who uses motorized transport is subsidized more than people who use either walking or biking. Not only that, walking and biking are green commute methods, greening the first and the last mile potentially, particularly with Caltrain Bikes on Board program. And so it has the social benefits as well as the financial benefits. We're thrilled and happy to report that Caltrain is making wonderful progress on improving its onboard bike capacity. They're in the process of adding 8 bike spaces per bike car by the end of July 2009. It's a 28% increase. They're also converting 2 existing cars to bike cars by September 2009, considering the possible conversion of a third. And one-third of the trains are specified to have 80 bike spaces, which is fabulous. Unfortunately, it's not guaranteed, but it is a step in the right direction. Caltrain has said this is an interim solution, which is wonderful because this is not expected to meet demand. It is a step in the right direction, but we do need more onboard bike capacity. After September 2009, two-thirds of the trains will vary unpredictably with 24, 40, 48, or 80 bikes per train. Now, when a train with 80 bike spaces pulls up, we'll all get on. When a train with 24 bike spaces pulls up, it'll be a bit of a gamble and we may get bumped. Inconsistent service drives away paying customers, and that's something Caltrain really can't afford right now. So what we need is a consistent 80 bikes per train to meet demand. Bikes on Board continues to help Caltrain plan for success. We need better consistency today, but just as important is planning for those specifications for the new rolling stock for electrification. We have a real opportunity here because we can plan for the onboard bike service instead of trying to force fit it into an existing system. It's a very exciting opportunity, and we're really looking forward to working with Caltrain on this solution. So in conclusion, bike plus train truly is a perfect combination. It's green for the planet, wonderful for society, convenient for commuters, which is why we all love it, and it's cost-effective for transit agencies. So we recommend a sustained mode shift in the future. It makes good environmental sense and good business sense to shift from motorized transport to walking and biking. Thank you very much.
Our next panel member is Corinne Winter.
Thanks, Gary. And I just noticed how great it felt to stand up, so I'm going to invite everyone for the first 30 seconds of my 15 minutes to stand up if you want and stretch your legs, because we've all been sitting a really long time. Please don't leave, otherwise I'll regret doing this. So you can sit down when you feel like it. I'm just going to start talking. So I definitely think transit and bicycles are natural transportation partners. This isn't, can you hear me? It's not rocket science, you know. How we do it is certainly a matter of debate, and I think a lot of things rest on the shift that I feel is currently happening within public agencies currently and with political will. Things are currently shifting so that bicycles are more a part of the transportation process, and there's a lot of evidence of that. What Sean was saying in terms of the complete streets policy, the great things we're seeing come out of the city of San Jose, Caltrain working more to accommodate cyclists. So this is happening, but there's, of course, a lot of how do we do it and who is it going to work for? I also think that one of the really big issues is the topic of latent demand, which I think a couple of the panelists touched on. There are a lot of people that might use bikes in transit if they felt like it was more possible for them. Those are people that might be just on bikes, just on transit, or using the auto for their trips primarily right now. So I think that's a big issue, and there's a lot of data that needs to be collected, as Sean was getting at, to target that. How many people would be using these facilities if we did build them? And somebody had said, if we build them, they will come, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. But if we get data to that effect, then there'll be more political will behind building these facilities for cyclists and with partnership with transit as well. So for me, I think there's a few critical topics in bike commuting right now. One, as Shirley very well spoke on, was the onboard accommodation on transit, which I feel as well is a huge issue, and I'm very thankful that Bikes on Board has done so much to promote that. We've also worked with Caltrain extensively on their capacity on the trains, and there's both short-term and long-term issues there. They're planning on converting their rolling stock at some point in the next few years. It's really uncertain right now when that'll happen. And we've been very pleased to see them accommodate cyclists, taking out seats, getting more bikes onto the boards in the meantime. But I think for us, the long-term, what do we end up with in this area that's going to serve transit users for the next several decades? That is a critical thing, and we look forward to seeing more dialogue about that and getting more public input on that. Another issue is how do we simplify getting our bikes on board? And it's a little chaotic sometimes on the platforms with bikes. And so can we have real-time information distributed to cyclists on the capacity for the trains? Things like that matter a lot when you're dealing with a train that's trying to come into the station and pull out again as soon as possible. And then how do we just deal with the boarding process? As I think Shirley mentioned right now, bicyclists are supposed to disembark after the non-cycling customers of Caltrain, and so that can create other issues, and we can probably work out a system whereby the boarding process is modified in a positive way. Second big issue is the wayside solutions, which we think are very important as well. About, I think, 8 or 9 months ago, we called together a roundtable of about 40 different groups, both businesses and agencies, cities, VTA, Caltrain, and we said, hey, you know, no matter how many bikes we get on the transit systems here in Silicon Valley, it's never going to be enough. We're always going to need other options for people, and there are some people who don't need to have their bike with them at all times, and those people could be served by a bike sharing system. And so we said, we need to make sure the system is consistent all throughout the region, all throughout the Bay Area is the hope. So you can, you know, get your bike share system pass and go pretty much anywhere and be assured of having a bike to take with you wherever you need to. I mean, to me, that sounds like heaven. So we're working with people to with VTA right now. Actually, there's a pilot project that we're working on with them to try and figure out what this might look like. And I know there's been a lot of activity in San Francisco with the MTA as well. And so hopefully we'll be able to coordinate this on a regional level. We're also trying to draw businesses into them here in Silicon Valley, into the system here in Silicon Valley in particular. There's a lot of businesses that are already creating bike share systems. Google, I think, I don't know if this is public information yet, has now a way to store bikes at the Caltrain system, and so their employees can come and then ride a Google bike from the Caltrain platform to the headquarters. And so in a public bike sharing system, we would have that for everybody, essentially, and have kiosks at all the major businesses, kiosks at all the Caltrain stations, kiosks at all of the downtown central areas, wherever you might want to go. This is complicated. As some of you who know, who visited European countries and other country or other cities here in the United States, know that, you know, it's clear soon when you start a system like this that you have to do what's called rebalancing. You have to move all the bikes around every night. Because people aren't necessarily consistent in their patterns of use. So it is certainly an operational issue, which is why we're getting everybody involved talking about it right from the get-go and hoping that we'll be able to create a uniform system across the Bay Area at some point. Another wayside solution, of course, is storage improvements. Again, not rocket science. I think a lot of the agencies are working on that, but I think it would be great if we eventually have a uniform storage system. So I think part of the reason cyclists don't use this more, I've never used it. I've never taken advantage of it. I think a lot of the transit stops have open lockers, but it's too complicated. I have to figure out too much about my schedule. I have to, you know, call this transit agency to get a locker set up here, or call this one to get a locker set up there. If we can somehow, with maybe guidance from MTC or other regional bodies, create some sort of a uniform system, that'll make things a lot easier for people to use those systems. Another priority for me is the actual infrastructure design around transit stations and in transit corridors. This is something both SFBC and SVBC work on quite a bit, is this concept of green mobility and how do we make it so that people can live and work and walk in these neighborhoods and bike in these neighborhoods and be able to have safe, pleasant access to transit. Right now, we're focused on the Dearden station area project. I don't know how many of you are aware of this yet, but the city of San Jose applied for a grant and got almost $1 million to redo the planning in a half-mile radius around Dearden Station. Stadium or no stadium, that's going to be a big project. And we're working with Greenbelt Alliance and some other organizations to ensure that bicyclists and pedestrians are accommodated in that, and the streets are designed in a way that are really conducive to people using those streets right around the station and to get between the station and downtown or their home with a bike or by foot. And there's, you know, as most people in this room know, an incredible amount you can do there. So there'll be public meetings and things on this if you guys are interested in that, keep an eye out. So we've also, shifting gears a little bit, done a lot of work with businesses. As I mentioned before, people want to be able to ride from the train to their business, but they also need to be able to ride from their home to business, and there's a lot of things that the businesses can do to encourage people to bike in. You know, as Carl mentioned earlier, our big three ticket items are giving people a transition space. It doesn't need to be a shower, but there are two different activities, biking and working. You know, you need some type of way to convert, whether it's clothing or whatever, just to have a space to make that transition. That needs to be provided to people. They need a place to store their bike securely, you know, whether that's at their desk or in a locker room, generally not outside in the rain, somewhere in the back parking lot. You know, it's got to be better than that. And then also the company messaging, we think, is really important. If the executives at the company say, hey, this is something we promote, people really, I think, follow that. So I also just wanted to give the city of San Jose some credit here. John Brazil has been doing a huge amount there, and I didn't even realize until they applied for certification how much they've been doing. But we gave them our highest rating, which is the platinum rating. They were the only company or workplace in the initial round that got that rating. And it's because of things like above and beyond showers, they have bikes available for employees to use during the day. And they also have a really robust program where they're encouraging cycling events like the City of San Jose Cycling Classic. And so I actually was surprised, honestly. I had no idea that you guys did so much, and so congratulations for that. And another thing we do in terms of removing barriers to cyclists is a lot of people tell me, oh, well, I would ride to work, but I just don't feel safe. So we launched our Share the Road initiative, where we're going around, and we're not going to solve the problem overnight, obviously, but going around and we're talking to groups, both cycling groups and motorist groups, with a presentation and trying to promote education for the cyclists on proper lane positioning, proper traffic behavior, and trying to generate more awareness with the motorists as well. We're also revamping our incident report. We've had this for a long time on our website, but what cyclists can do is anytime there's been they've been a victim of aggressive behavior, they can give us that data, and then we're going to be keeping that data and seeing if there's patterns, seeing if there's specific locations that are problems that we need to address, or if there's specific motorists, or if we get license plate numbers repeatedly and things, that's something we can go to the local jurisdiction with and say, you know, what should we do about this? So there are a lot of things that we're working on right now. In general, I think it's mostly about a constructive dialogue. That's been the focus of the Silicon Valley Bicycle Coalition, to work with agencies, to work with the public, to figure out how can we create a better situation for cyclists and make it more possible for people to bike commute. Thanks.
Our next panel member is John Brazil, the head of the Bicycle Pedestrian Program in San Jose. And one of the things that John has been a key in getting implemented are safety classes, in which they give away free helmets to the first 25 or so bicyclists who sign up. And as a way of telling them there is a way you can commute to work safely.
Thank you, Gary. If you can't hear me at any point, just raise your hand and or say speak up or move the microphone. Especially important because this will probably be rebroadcast over the radio and they can't see, so over the radio. My name is John Brazil, and I work for the City of San Jose's Bicycle and Pedestrian Program in the Department of Transportation. So I have a local perspective. We're here in San Jose, those of you that are here live and not going to be listening over the radio. I'm going to talk about a few things, but there were so many interesting points that were raised with the other panelists that I may meander a bit. So I hope you'll kind of indulge me if I meander a bit from regular talking points and just work with my throwing out ideas. But what I wanted to talk about briefly is big picture, why should we even care about any of this? Really big step out of our little world here. Secondly, just bicycling generally. Third, what's San Jose doing? And then fourth, I'm kind of going from the big, focusing down into the theme of this panel discussion, which is bicycling in the last mile and transit. So I hope that works for everyone. So let's dive in and see what kind of chaos ensues. Big issues, some of the previous panelists mentioned these, but you know, why should we really care? We're busy day in and day out. What does it really matter? Well, I'd argue there are at least three reasons that come to mind for me. And yes, we've heard them all before, but they're real. Climate change is real, whether we want to accept it or not. It's a reality. It may not affect us, but our kids or our grandkids are surely going to be affected, so we ought to be responsible and do something about it. Clearly, as one of the previous panelists mentioned, actually, I think our keynote, Carl Guardino, in the Bay Area, 50% of our emissions, carbon emissions, come from transportation. So part of the solution, part of that solution to that problem is going to be bikes. The second really big issue is one of public health, and that sounds vague, but make it personal. You may know somebody who has diabetes, and certain types of diabetes are caused by a sedentary lifestyle, among other things, and diet. And so the more we can move and exercise, the more we can solve these public health issues. So it doesn't solve the whole problem, but this is a real crisis in the public health system, and getting people to move a little more can help solve that. So big picture, bicycling is real there. And then if anyone listened to the governor's address to legislature last night, we know that the state and local government budget issues are worsening. And that may impact me more directly because I work for a government agency, but it's going to impact you as well because cities and states don't have enough money to do what they want to do, to pave the roads, to provide the public services. Well, how does that relate to bicycling? Well, kind of indirectly, but I work in a Department of Transportation, and I know that a large portion of our budget goes to simply maintaining the pavement on streets. A large portion just maintaining the pavement on streets. So what do you think is going to and I'm oversimplifying, this is just one of many issues, but what's going to cause a street to wear out more, a 4,000-pound car or a 25-pound bike? And that's a big oversimplification. It's not that simple. And we're not going to, I'm not proposing we get rid of all the cars, but if somebody threw out a 10% goal, if we have 10% of trips by bike instead of the current average 2% in San Jose, it's going to long-term have a positive impact. And those millions that we need for pavement maintenance, maybe we can reduce them a little and save some money and pay for other services you want. So kind of the three big issues I think that are relevant. Why should we even talk about bicycling? Okay, so what is San Jose doing? Well, first, I'll throw out all the bragging rights because I have to do that, and I like to do that. And then I'll talk about things we're doing. So bragging rights. As Corinne Winter, Executive Director of Silicon Valley Bicycle Coalition, mentioned, we were one of the first four workplaces in Silicon Valley and also in the peninsula, I believe, as well, to receive bicycle-friendly workplace designation. And we were actually the only employer to receive it at the platinum level. Well, that means that we're making bicycling easier for employees. We have fleet bikes for employees to use if they want to make a business trip that's close by, work-related. They can check out an employee fleet bike. And it's also acceptable to take it out for a lunch break for health and wellness. That's part of the philosophy behind the health and wellness of employees. We have, of course, showers for employees that ride to work. We have secure bike parking, lots of features. We have transit benefits so our employees can get free transit passes through VTA and subsidized transit passes through other agencies. So that we got our bike-friendly workplace reward. We've been re-upped or reauthorized as one of only 100 cities in the country to be designated a bicycle-friendly community by the League of American Bicyclists. That's fantastic. We're proud of that. Bicycling Magazine, the leading bike magazine in the U.S., designated San Jose one of the top three most improved bicycling cities this past year. So it says we're making progress. We have further to go. We have one of only 22 national recreational trail designations in the country, and I think the only one in California. Our trail program manager is sitting here. I think we're the only one in California to get that designation. A great and developing trail system. We have hosted international bike races, the Amgen Tour of California, for four consecutive years. We're one, the only community in Northern California with a velodrome, which is one of those tracks where you can race a bicycle. And we were the first city to host the North American Handmade Bike Show, one of only four cities to host the Live Strong Challenge, Lance Armstrong Foundation's event where you raise funds by getting contributions to bike or run. And the funding goes towards cancer research. So those are the bragging rights. Okay, get those out of the way, blah, 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 right? So what's going on in San Jose, and what's San Jose like for bicycling? For those people listening that aren't from this community, we're a city of 1,007,000 approximately, 10th largest city in the U.S., so we're a pretty big city. We have a relatively flat climate, a relatively mild climate and flat topography. That's perfect for bicycling, just what we need, right? But as I mentioned, we're only slightly above average nationally, about 2% of trips by bike. So we clearly need to do something more. So what is that something more? And before I talk about what we're doing, I want to talk about target audiences. A lot of times I find, in my opinion, bike planners and transportation planners, particularly bike planners, we preach to the choir. We preach to that 2% that are riding a bike now. And that's great, but I don't want to just preach to 2% and stay at 2% or 3%. I want to reach the quote-unquote latent bicyclist, the person who's saying, I might bike, but I just don't feel right. Or the person who's not even thinking of bicycling. I want to be like some countries in Europe where there are 40% of trips by bike. Not 2%, 40%. We're not going to get there immediately, but to get even close to that goal, we have to stop. I shouldn't say stop. We have to preach to more than just the choir, more than just the person who's already riding, feels comfortable riding in traffic, is putting on the Lycra and racing on weekends. That turns the latent bicyclists off. So how do we reach that additional audience, the average person? Well, what's their concern? Why aren't they bicycling now? The things I hear repeatedly are, one, I don't feel safe riding in traffic, and two, it's just not convenient. And this is going to tie into the transit link when I get to that point. I didn't look at my time, but I'll try and get there. So safety, well, I'd argue we do detailed collision analysis in San Jose for years. We know factually what the risks are, and we know what we need to do to make things safer. But to oversimplify one of them is very challenging. It's slowing cars down. But there are a lot of other things we can do and are doing to improve our bikeways. But in addition to the factual, this is what we need to do to make the road safer, just as important is the perception of safety. I can sit here as a transportation planner and say, why aren't you riding? I don't feel safe on that road. And then I could say, well, factually, it's safe. They'll say, I don't care about factually. I don't feel safe. So this goes into how, again, we reach that audience of getting more people to bike and use transit, TripLink. So what we're doing in San Jose is updating our bike plan. Currently, we have our old bike plan, which is 8 years old, calls for building about 300 miles of bikeways. That would include about 100 miles of trails and 200 miles of on-street bikeways. To date, we've built about 230 total miles. So that's 50 miles of trails are done, about 160 miles of bike lanes on the streets, and 20 miles of bike routes. So it's good progress. But when we update our bike plan, which we're doing now, we realize we need a couple things. One, a bigger network of bikeways. Actually, I should say three things. A bigger network of bikeways, because while we can ride on any street legally as a bicyclist, we may not feel comfortable on any street. So we want to have a bigger network of bikeways. 450 total miles will be our goal. Two is we realize that most people don't like riding on streets. So what we need to do is form kind of a backbone of bikeways that are off-street that people feel more comfortable on. And that's our great trail network that Yves Zudi manages. And as I said, we have about 50 of 100 miles done. So that just like you'd get on the freeway to get to your destination, you can get on a trail and get to your destination. The trick is we need the on-street bikeways too, because probably 99% of destinations are off the trail system. So trails are great. We all want to be there. We're going to make them a great environment. But we need to have the on-street connections to get to transit stations or to wherever our destination is. So this is a key feature. And third of our bike plan, one of the key features is that we realize the traditional bike facilities on streets aren't enough. Half the people in the room said that they bike, so you probably feel comfortable on a bike lane on a street, a stripe and a sign and a little space. The other 98% of people often don't, and that's why they don't ride. So what we're doing in San Jose is saying we want to enhance some of the bike lanes on street, the primary ones that go to key destinations like transit centers. So we're looking at a variety, a palette of options to enhance a basic bike lane. It could be providing some physical separation from traffic, could be coloring the bike lane, could be providing buffered space, et cetera. Things to make people feel more comfortable, because they need to feel comfortable or they won't ride a bike. So other things that San Jose has been doing, people talked about, you know, you need a shower at your destination. If you're going a long way or if it's a hot day, you may need a shower. So our municipal code has had for at least 8 years requirements for new development to have showers, new development, and to have bike parking. So that's good. We're going to strengthen that and continue doing that. Those are key issues, I think. So as a lot of folks have mentioned, transit is key here. I take my bike every day to work, and oftentimes I link it with transit, and that's wonderful, and Caltrain's fantastic. It's been a national leader in accommodating bikes, but as some have said, you know, success creates some challenges, and so that's part of the discussion here. I think the panelists have named a variety of solutions that I all support. I think we're going to need a palette of solutions to make sure that people can get to the station. It's my job, a comfortable place to ride to the station, and then can have a safe option for their bike, whether it's taking it on board or parking it or renting a public bike through the bike fleet. These are all important, and my personal perspective is that in the short term, I applaud San Francisco Bicycle Coalition for seeking more access on board. And I also believe that in the long term, even if we could fill the trains completely with bikes, that's not enough. We need to have additional options. We can learn some lessons from other communities, particularly in Europe and Asia, that have larger bike mode shares and larger transit use shares. I mean, you see at some transit stations, not hundreds, but thousands of parked bikes. It's simply not possible for us to get thousands of bikes on the trains. So on board is part of the solution, but we need to have other options, bike share, unstaffed bike stations, staffed bike stations, whatever they may be, a palette of solutions. I also wanted to applaud Councilmember Sam Liccardo and Mayor Chuck Reed for pushing some of the issues about making bicycling more convenient in San Jose. Councilmember Liccardo was one of the prime movers in realizing that the average person doesn't feel comfortable riding on the street. That's why they're not riding. So we need to do something more for them. So that's great. I also wanted to mention our local congestion management agency and transit operator, which is Valley Transportation Authority. They operate the buses that all allow bikes, and the light rail that all allow bikes. They also do the planning, and they, just yesterday we met with VTA, they're developing a pilot project for some type of, to develop a plan for a pilot public bike share at three transit stations in our county. So planning is in the works. We'll need to identify funding once the plans are done to implement, but eventually we'll see a public bike share pilot at the train station here in San Jose, Dearden, probably in Mountain View, and probably in Palo Alto up the line. That's fantastic. Let's see. Also wanted to share, this is where I'm getting a little random jumping around. I hope you'll work with me. Share a notion of the most vulnerable user. So I'm talking about transportation facility user. The most vulnerable user is probably not a person in a car because they have 4,000 pounds of metal around them. I drive a car once in a while, so there's nothing wrong with driving a car. But I suspect that the most vulnerable user, or more than suspect, I know, is a pedestrian or a bicyclist. So there's a nascent but growing notion that transportation planners ought to put as a priority the most vulnerable users, a top priority, instead of having the top priority single-occupant vehicles, cars. Maybe we should reverse that and say, let's prioritize pedestrians, bikes, transit, and then cars will, you know, we'll work on too. But so that's a concept that I think is whose time has come. Another idea I wanted to mention, Gary, tell me if I'm running out of time, is, and this one's a little hard to explain, but again, let's think about other communities where bicycling is mainstream. Some of you have lived or visited European countries where the bike mode share may be 40%, and then you add walking maybe, you know, 20 or 30% transit, and then the actual single-occupant vehicle mode is incredibly low. But the point is, with the high bike mode share, where people bike a lot, that's a great goal to reach. In the States, where people don't bike, we talk about bike culture. There's this group there, this bike culture. But if you go to a country with 40% mode share, there isn't a bike culture. It is. People, it's part of their life so much that they don't think about it. So bike culture is great. You know, you can fit whatever subculture you want, the body piercing, the tattoo, the tri guy, or, you know, whatever bike culture you want. But wouldn't it be great if we got to a place where bikes were so much part of culture that you didn't think about it anymore? So I think that's something that we should really embrace. Well, I think that out of respect for everyone's time, we want to get to your questions. I'll sum up there. So thank you all for coming.
And anchoring us today is Mark Simon. Caltrain, Samtrans, anything on the peninsula, Mark knows.
Thank you, Gary. As Gary mentioned, I am a recovering journalist. You know, you really need to start thinking about your career options, pal. Look what's happened in the newspapers. Thank you very much for letting me be here today. I want to thank the Mineta Transportation Institute and Rod Dearden in particular. I want to thank the FTA and the MTC, largely because they're the guys with the money and no bucks, no Buck Rogers. And I want to thank the Silicon Valley Bicycle Coalition for its sponsorship and for the leadership Corinne has shown there. And I got to tell you, it's a special day. I don't think I've ever seen Shirley in anything other than spandex before. You did ride your bike here.
Absolutely.
Well, then how did you get those big things here?
Sherpas.
Okay. So somebody else. It's always helpful to have help. I want to talk about two things real quickly and then get on to the main topic. I would be remiss if I didn't tout the Tour de Peninsula, which is a bike ride I started 20 years ago. The Silicon Valley Bike Coalition is a sponsor of it. It's August 2nd. It is a fun ride. As I like to say, it's not a race, it's a ride. Benefits the San Mateo County Parks Foundation, and in particular, their Bicycle Sundays program. And I don't know how many of you bike in San Mateo County at all and are familiar with Kenyatta Road, but they close it every Sunday to automobile traffic. It's a great thing. It's especially a great thing for getting new people to learn to ride bikes and to be comfortable. We talk a lot about traffic and the uncertainties that people feel. This is a great way to get people at it. So I thought I'd make a shameless plug for my bike ride. The other thing I wanted to tout is a June 20th forum in Redwood City. It's free. It's something called the Grand Boulevard Initiative Forum. and it's relevant to this particular group, and I'll explain why Caltrain is involved in it in a second. It is an attempt to transform El Camino, basically from San Jose to Daly City, into a world-class boulevard. It is pedestrian-friendly, that is certainly bicycle-friendly, that it basically embraces and exhibits all of the concepts we talk about, that we need transit-oriented development, that we need walkable, bikeable communities. We need these places to be served by transit. We need them to be places where people can live, where there are clusters of businesses rather than El Camino's historic string of businesses that seem to be going out of business about every 5 years unless you're a Chinese restaurant. So that's an important event, and I think this group in particular would be well served to go there. I mention that even though SamTrans, the San Mateo County Transit District, is a sponsor, because it's always useful in a forum like this to explain. I should take a point. I taught for 5 years. I taught journalism at San Jose State. One of my former students is here, Steve French. Steve, I expect 500 words on this in about 2 o'clock with an anecdotal lead. A little journalism humor, Gary. San Mateo County Transit District is a partner in Caltrain with VTA and the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. What does that mean? It means that right now Caltrain is funded by the state and federal funds we get, by our fare box, and by subsidies provided by those three agencies. Shirley made reference to the meeting we're having tomorrow, the public hearing to declare a fiscal emergency. We have a structural deficit that's somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 to $30 million. We've managed to get our annual deficit down from $10 million this year to about 2.7, and we're going to have to make some service cuts and increase parking fees, which probably makes bicyclists happy, and increase the cost we charge for the GoPass to balance the budget. But we have a structural deficit that isn't helped any by the fact that the three agencies that fund Caltrain all have structural deficits of their own. This year, the state legislature zeroed out the State Transit Assistance Fund, which is a major source of revenue for all three agencies. It's for the next 4 years. It's what we call the state government diet. If you can survive after 4 years, then that proves you didn't really need it. I'm glad to hear that we're described as the national leader in onboard bicycles. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. It isn't something we set out to do. In 1992, which is when Caltrain was formed as a joint power agency, took over, we started allowing 4 bikes on a few trains. By mid-1995, we became bike accessible on 12 bikes per train on all trains. 1996, we doubled it to 24 per train. From 2000 to 2001, we increased on our gallery cars from 24 to 32. Our gallery cars are the big shiny ones. The Bombardier cars are the red and gray ones. From 2004 to 2008, we increased our service levels from 76 trains a day to ultimately 98 trains a day, and that, by definition, increased our bike service. Our onboard capacity at the time this was written, was 32 spaces per gallery and 16 for the Bombardiers. We are now in the middle of a program that Shirley alluded to. We are increasing the space on the gallery cars from 32 to 40. In an unfortunate burst of enthusiasm, emailed my own mailing list. I now have a mailing list of more than 400 bicyclists who use Caltrain. In a burst of enthusiasm that was misplaced, told them we had finished converting all of the gallery cars to additional bike space. We actually still have 3 left to do, but they should be done, if not by the end of this week, by the end of next week. Of course, those are the same people that told me it was done already, so be careful what you do with that piece of information. So we're increasing those bikes from 32 bike slots to 40. We're also increasing the Bombardier cars from 16 to 24. We actually proposed more, but the bicycling community, and one of those examples where it's useful to have input, several people were worried if we took all the seats out, then they'd have to stand with their bike to make sure no one stole it. And we talked at the very beginning of this show about the disappointment we've all had when we've walked out. I've had the same experience. You walk out, and you look where your bike is supposed to be, and you start thinking to yourself, well, did I leave it there? Maybe I left it somewhere else. You don't want to believe that someone took your bike, and then someone did. So we understand that. We're also committed to putting two bike cars on as many of the peak commute trains as possible. We mentioned, I think Shirley alluded to, we are in the process of converting two other additional Bombardier cars to bike cars, and we're probably going to convert one more. And if we do that, then all five of the train sets we have for Bombardiers will be two bike car sets. In addition to what we expect to be able to do with the gallery cars, we think that we actually will help resolve some of the consistency issues. We recognize that consistency is a critical issue. That's one of the things that affects all of our customers. And everything we do, we have to do in the context of our whole system. So that's one of the issues that we continue to face is what is going to be the impact of this on the rest of our service, on our on-time performance, on our reliability, on everybody else who also rides the train. It's been an interesting series of experiences for us to learn how to work with the biking community. As I said, it wasn't something we set out to do, to become such a prominent participant as a carrier of bicycles. And it was true, probably, that when we started it, it was a novelty so much as we thought of it as an extra, something we were doing in addition. I think in the last year and a half, one of the things that we've learned is that we really can't treat it that way anymore, that we have to regard it as essentially a central part of our service. Not the only part of our service, certainly, but something that we think we're in the business. There was always sort of an undercurrent of, well, it's something we're doing. We may keep doing it. We may not keep doing it. We're going to keep doing it, and we're going to keep working with the bicycling community to see how we can make it better. That includes everything from more information, more real-time information. Right now, Caltrain doesn't provide any real-time information, not just for cyclists, but for anybody, because we don't have the infrastructure to do that. Again, no Bucks, no Buck Rogers. The other thing that I want to dwell on a little bit is not dwell time, because we can debate all we want to about that, but that's the fact is we worry about whether or not we're on time, and dwell time is one of the things that prevents us from being. You know what dwell time is? Everybody, anybody? It's how long the train has to stay at the station before it gets going again. We did do a bicycle access and parking plan. That became really the first full sort of engagement of the cycling community, because somebody made the mistake of referring to it when they first planned it as the bicycle master plan. And, of course, the bicycling community wanted to know why the bicycle master plan wasn't addressing bikes on board. Well, because it really wasn't supposed to be that. We got grant funding to do it, and the grant funding was for studying wayside facilities. So we mislabeled it. That created some significant confusion that's our own fault, and the debate ensued from there. The main thing is, and I'm glad to hear Shirley praise the bicycle access and parking plan, because we do think that wayside facilities, how we allow people to access the train station, what's available for them once they get there, is a major way of meeting the demand for bicycles for that last mile. I have a cold. If you're listening at home, there's always a guy who's coughing during these speeches. That was me today. Excuse me for sniffling. We realize that the main recommendations of the bicycle access and parking plan includes cyclist-specific customer service and marketing. It is a unique segment of our customer base, and we need to recognize that and treat it accordingly. We have to increase the overall bicycle parking supply. We have to find a way to make the bike parking we provide more meaningful to people, meaning that it's safe first and foremost. We have some bike lockers that some people have moved into, not with their bikes, but with all their worldly possessions, and that's not really what they're for. So we need to be more understanding of what will make it available to people, what will make it meaningful and useful to people, and find ways to do that, because, frankly, it will ease some of the demand on board if we can provide people meaningful alternatives to parking their bike. We want to work with cities to improve station bike access. I referenced the Grand Boulevard Initiative. That's a good example of really high-level thinking about how do we transform the entire nature of a major boulevard, and how do we get the individual cities to start thinking more thoughtfully about how these things all interrelate. And then we want to study innovative station-side concepts such as real-time bicycle capacity information, bike sharing, subsidies for folding bikes. We actually have a legislative request in to one of the legislators in San Mateo County for a pilot program for subsidizing a bike sharing program. Also subsidizing bike folding bikes, because there's more room on the train for those than there are for those that can't be folded. So That's one of the things we're working on. Where does all this lead? We have to assess, when we are done with the current expansion project, we have to assess its impact on our system. We're going to end up spending about $350,000 that we don't really have to do this. I don't say we don't really have it because I don't want it to sound begrudging, but these are tough times for all public agencies and for transit in particular that doesn't really have an organized advocacy group in Sacramento. I was going to say Washington, but the great irony is Sacramento keeps cutting the money, and transportation money is gushing out of Washington in the form of high-speed rail money and stuff like that. So we certainly need help advocating for transit in general, and as we can grow transit, we can certainly grow bicycle capacity. As I said, we have to assess the impact of this and see if it's meeting the demand. If there's more demand, what can we do? What should we do? Where are we going to get the money to do it would be the next step. We're going to form a bicycle advisory committee. We have been meeting internally to discuss it. It's something we've been very slow to get to, partly because we're all preoccupied with our budget issues. Samtrans is facing layoffs, and I've been out of the business for 5 years. This is the first time I've had to sit through one of these meetings where you go from discussing we're going to have to lay off 10 people to, oh, here are the 10 people we're going to lay off. And it's a whole different discussion when you suddenly realize these are people you know and have lunch with. We're going to continue to pursue the initiatives described in the bike access and parking plan. That information is on our website, by the way, at caltrain.com. The next meaningful leap forward, really, in terms of our ability to expand capacity, is going to be when we expand the whole capacity of the rail system. We have plans to electrify Caltrain, in theory, by 2015, and to change to a whole new technology of rolling stock that Corinne alluded to, called electric multiple units. What it would mean is that the train is no longer a heavy locomotive that drags along a bunch of cars. Each car will have its own power, which means it's much more flexible, which means it's much more efficient. So that, for example, one of our most popular trains are the express trains that can go from San Jose to San Francisco in under an hour and makes 4 stops. Under this new system, which we expect will be fully realized by 2025, we're going to make that run from San Jose to San Francisco in about an hour, but make 14 stops. There'll be so much more service that whether or not there's room on a bike. The problem now isn't just that people get bumped. It's a lot of times when they wait for the next train, they get bumped on that one too. That's been a problem that we're trying to fix in the interim. There'll be so much service that in theory, this won't be the same problem that it is now. So that's the big step forward. All of this is compounded by high-speed rail. Clearly, Caltrain has formed a partnership with high-speed rail. We're still ironing out the details of that. But there are a number of things that high-speed rail needs to do that we need to do. And there's an economy of scale to be gained. There are efficiencies to be gained. And frankly, there's an opportunity for us to make some of these changes for Caltrain using high-speed rail money because they would serve high-speed rail's interests as well. So again, Corinne asked me just before she came up here where we stood on replacing the rolling stock, and the answer is we have to wait and see what sort of relationship we iron out with high-speed rail. There are a number of people, especially in the central part of the peninsula, Palo Alto, Menlo Park, Atherton, who are increasingly alarmed by high-speed rail. If you support high-speed rail, you need to make sure people hear that point of view as well. I understand their concerns. They're worried about the damage it might do to their community. But we think of this as a fantastic opportunity to serve a greater number of people in a hugely more efficient way, in a more effective and a more modern way, and that would certainly include the bicycling community. So what have we learned? We probably should have been more communicative and more transparent from the beginning. We are adding extra service, extra capacity. That some of the bicyclists love to be collaborative. Some of them have a history of being adversarial, and that's okay. That's what they're used to. That's who they are. That's how they get things done, and I say that without any pejorative intent. And we are continuing to concern ourselves with the system impact of all of these changes, but we recognize that the bicycle service is here to stay, and it's a customer segment that we have to pay serious attention to. Thank you.
We're going to resume here at the question and answer session. Again, you line up at the microphone. Before we do that, I'd just like to mention that on July 11th, Breathe California is having a Bike for Breath ride on the peninsula, several rides, and the phone number that Rod asked me to give out is 650-994-5868. If you would just introduce yourself, if you're affiliated with a group, please say so, and direct your question to whoever you would like.
I'm Jeffrey Oldham. I ride Caltrain, and I've been working with Bikes on Board. We've been talking about the first and last mile of and how bicycles are involved in that, but I want to talk about the middle mile. So the middle mile is that segment in your journey that doesn't have adequate public transportation service. So why does this happen? Well, transit stations are not necessarily next to each other. Famously, London and Paris have this problem. We have this problem with BART and Amtrak and Fremont and Oakland. We have this problem in San Francisco. We have non-uniform scheduling. For example, Caltrain doesn't service all Tamian, so there's a gap there for some services. There's a time savings because I can cycle faster than I can transfer. There's also money savings because I may not have to pay an additional fare. I can't usually cycle faster to chase another service, so solving the uncoordinated schedule problem is not solved by cycling. So I'd like to know, how does the proposals of parking and bike sharing and bringing my bicycle on board, and other approaches, how do they address the middle mile problem?
I'll jump in. This is John Brazil. Well, it seems to me the middle mile is, to some extent, the responsibility of the local agencies and cities. The transit operators have stations, particularly fixed transit, rail transit, so, you know, it's not their obligation they cannot provide stops every 100 yards. So it comes down to cities creating a continuous network of bikeways and prioritizing the development of streets in ways that encourage bicycling rather than discourage. And that's a whole other subject, but that's city's job, I think, to do that.
Kevin?
Yeah, Jeff, I think you've actually put your finger on a very important issue, and that is trying to articulate where bicycling and transit is superior than bicycling versus transit. Because if you take a look at land use patterns and the average bicycle trip, which is something around 5 miles or so, you can actually get to more things quicker riding the bike, as you articulated, than you can on transit. That is, bicycling, for those of us that do it, actually provides greater accessibility and greater mobility than transit. So what it begs us to think about is exactly, for example, the situation where I live. And I live in Boulder, but frequently I teach and work in Denver. I've never had more than a 5-minute commute in my whole life. I now have an hour commute, and I'm willing to bike 40, 50 miles one way. But the time cost advantages of such prohibit such. So I can't bike to work anymore. I have to ride my bike to the bus station and do exactly this, and then take the bus to work. So what this suggests is that there's a certain distance. I would say it's probably 10, 15, 12 miles that transit usurps bicycling, and that's where the market that we're really talking about. But your points of those trips that are less than 10 miles are well taken.
Okay, thank you. The panel members, when you do speak, if you could just introduce your name as well. Mark?
One of the things we're looking at increasingly, I'm Mark Simon, I should give instructions and then I ignore them. We're looking increasingly at partnerships and how we can expand the network. In San Mateo County, for example, between SamTrans and Caltrain, we do a pretty good job of going north to south. But most people live east to west, and how do you fill in that other trip? How do you provide service to people in that direction? And that's the next big challenge, and it really is, as Kevin alluded to, not just a transit challenge, it's really a planning challenge. How do you get cities to begin to think about this, first of all, as their responsibility, whether it's something they have to take on directly themselves or identify partnerships, but how can they begin to plan their communities so that it serves people getting to and from the main trunk line? Because that's really what you're talking about in some ways is, no, maybe not then, since you're shaking your head. But the middle mile, but the fact is getting to and from places that aren't served conveniently by the main system is something that I think that it takes a holistic approach, a whole range of communities to respond to.
Yes.
This is John Brazil. I'd like to add one thing that's part of the solution, I think, is one of the policies the city of San Jose has. Those of you familiar with transportation planning, when a new development is built, there's traditional traffic impact analysis that says if somebody's going to build a high-rise office building, it's going to create X amount of car trips, and the developer has to mitigate that by usually making the road bigger. Well, San Jose has said there are certain parts of town where we don't want to encourage more car traffic. And so rather than that traditional business of saying, okay, developer, you need to make the car bigger, the road bigger for cars, we're going to say, developer, you need to mitigate the transportation impacts by funding improvements for pedestrians, bikes, and transportation. And so when a development happens in the middle mile in these locations in San Jose, rather than just building a bigger road, we're going to make the improvements for pedestrians, bicyclists, and to get to transit. So that's part of the solution.
Okay, next question.
Hi. My name's Tian Harder from Mountain View. I'm a green activist. And I just want to start by saying that transit is really a lot better than it used to be, and I'm very grateful for that. But nowadays, I live in fear of being bumped off of Caltrain or not getting on it, and I just had a couple of suggestions. One is, you know, if you could get the conductor to give people that are bumped like a pass to be first in line for the next train, then that way they wouldn't. It would be less likely to get bumped again. And another thing is, one thing I've seen more of lately is like people bring razor scooters kind of things because they're small and you don't need space for them. And maybe if you just mention that, it'll take a little bit of pressure off of the bike car.
Great suggestions. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Next.
Hi, my name is Michael Brio, and I was raised on the streets of Los Angeles. Actually, let me rephrase that. I was raised riding my bicycle on the streets of Los Angeles. So I'm a very hardcore urban bicyclist. I don't really consider myself part of the biking culture. I just always tuck my pants in my leg, and off I go on my bike. So I'm really one of the 2% that's part of the preaching to the choir, and I'm really interested. I should mention I'm also co-managing the general plan update for the city of San Jose. So what I'm really interested in is how do we get that other 98% of people to ride bicycles? And when I ride downtown with my fiance, it's not a problem. It's a city that was built before the Second World War. It's more pedestrian friendly, more bike friendly. But when we leave the old urban core, my fiance is like, that's it, riding on the sidewalk now. I'm not going with you unless we can ride on the sidewalk. And of course, one of the unintended consequences of all the ADA ramps that they put in as part of the ADA legislation is it facilitates riding on the sidewalks. And then I heard that West Hollywood has actually, I think they passed a law that allows you legally to ride on the sidewalk. And I have really mixed feelings about that, actually. I'm not saying I'm advocating for that. But I'm wondering in those places out in the post-war part of Silicon Valley, the auto-oriented places where you have expressways and major, you know, big six-lane arterials that when you get off the Caltrain, at the Caltrain station, you get off at the light rail station, that instead of having to ride with with the quick-moving traffic on a major arterial, which is probably actually factually safe, but it doesn't feel safe, that the cities are looking at opportunities where you could just ride on the sidewalk and make it more of an actual facility that's legal. That's my question.
Okay, thank you. Mark
Simon, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I think it's a really good opportunity to once again tout the Grand Boulevard Initiative Forum, June 20th, Redwood City. It's free, box lunch included. The reason I mention it is what you're talking about is going to require a whole rethinking of how these communities operate themselves, how they maintain themselves and sustain themselves financially. And it begins with them understanding that there is a financial model for the survival of their community that doesn't necessarily rely on a strip of small owner-occupied or fast food restaurants on El Camino, that there's a way to do this that really takes into account such things as, let's take portions of El Camino that are six lanes and make it four lanes. There are studies that show that when you reduce the amount of lanes available, traffic flow actually improves in automobiles. But now there's room for bicycles. There's room maybe for transit-dedicated lanes that can do skip-stop or express buses. So there's a lot of things that can be done, but it really requires a rethinking. And I suspect you understand that. But this is an opportunity to get on the ground floor of a place where we're going to address one of the major thoroughfares in our region. And so I urge everybody to go.
Kevin?
Yeah, we often talk about different types of cyclists, type A, B, and C cyclists, right, which basically group all cyclists according to regardless of their frequency into the types of facilities that they appreciate. But your question really gets at a larger issue about what Malcolm Gladwell, an author of Tipping Point, would talk about, you know, who is that tipping point? Who is that latent demand? And we don't really know that much about that population out there. But if I had to break the world down into four categories, and I think there are four categories when we talk about these related issues, there's the 1%, most likely like the people in this room, who are going to ride through good weather, bad weather, uphill, both ways, et cetera. And that's 1% of the population. There's, I would suggest, around 2/3 of the population, untouchable. They're not going to have anything to do with bicycling. Nor should we even try to bang our heads against the wall, because the best thing about banging your head against the wall is that it feels good when we stop, right? But what that suggests is that there's 67% plus 1% is 32% of the population out there. These are just estimates, which fall into one of two categories. There's the people who are out there cycling one time per week or so, and you know, we would like to see them cycling three or four or five times per week to work and then and going to the groceries. And then there are the people that have the old rickety bike in the garage that just need that additional impetus, right? And I think that's where we're talking about for this type of pursuits. But the key here is that this is only 12-15% of the total population. And we're only asking them to, or we're only expecting them possibly to be doing it 8, 12, 15 times per year. And so we have to be realistic in our expectations here. But I think breaking the world down into these different four categories, in which we're really only trying to tinker with roughly 1/3 of the population, I think is an important takeaway point.
Okay.
Alex from FTA. I think, well, in transit, I'm not as familiar with the bikes specifically, but I know that if you want to get people to ride transit, you have to make it fast, cheap, and they have to feel good about it. And I think some of that overlaps into the bike world as well. If they can do it quickly, they can feel safe and secure, and it's not, obviously it's not expensive, then they're more likely to do it. Another thing I might add is just being familiar with it. I mean, I commuted on my bike for the first time in San Francisco. It's a bit daunting. I didn't know which way to go. I looked at a route map. I still didn't feel comfortable, like, how I was going to get there. But after you do it once, if someone shows you, then it's easy to do it again and again and again. And you get used to it. So I think, you know, making sure that it's fast and if there's a way to do that and kind of lead people to it, they'll do it over and over.
John?
John Brazil, San Jose. I would agree with that. I would add to fast and cheap and modify that to say really it only needs to be faster and cheaper than the alternatives, which are often the car. And that's kind of a whole other discussion, the Holy Grail. But it doesn't have to be the fastest or the cheapest. But think about the denser communities where a lot of people walk or bike. It's because it's usually faster or cheaper than driving a car.
Shirley Johnson, I just want to mention that the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition has a program called Bike Buddies, and I am a bike buddy, so if anybody wants to learn any route in San Francisco, call me up.
Okay, next question.
Hi, I'm Carrie Haywood with the Moffett Park Business and Transportation Association, and some of you have already touched on the topic, but some of our work, we advocate for better infrastructure, but our biggest challenge is the latent demand and perception. And so many people love trains, but they have a negative connotation of buses. And so how do you change that perception? I'm still trying to find that magic wand, pixie dust, that encourages people to try transit or to get on a bike. And I don't know if some of you have some ideas that you've used or have looked into research that how do you get that perception changed for people to, once they try it a couple of times, then they usually buy in, but it's getting over that first hurdle.
Alex?
Well, the LA Rapid program that I mentioned did a phenomenal job of that with marketing, branding, a lot of its image. Again, the people, you know, if they can get there pretty quickly, they went, the new service was 30% or over 30% faster, and the ridership went up 30%. So it's just a matter of, you know, this is transit, you know, and providing a branded service that is attractive and appealing, and people feel good about it. People often don't like to stand next to a freeway and feel like, you know, that was a bad experience. So there's a lot of that going on, just the image.
Okay. Sean?
Sean Coe. A group in the Bay Area called Transform did this study called Travel Choices, and they basically went door-to-door in certain neighborhoods and provided transit information and just really had sort of one-on-one contact on transportation options for that area, and their outcomes were incredible in terms of getting people to take the bus, and a lot of it was just really small things, just getting the route information, showing them where the bus stop was, showing them how easy it could be, and has been very successful.
Okay.
Kevin Kreisick. Two points, both of which are, I think, somewhat serious, although the second is more flippant. There's not a lot of research out there that suggests that, well, there is a lot of research out there. The quality of the research and the consensus among the research is not there about the degree to which separated cycling facilities actually lead to safer cycling environments. What the research does conclude, however, is that separated cycling environments, particularly for Class B and Class C cyclists, Type B and Type C, lead to increased perception, increased perception that it is safer. And so regardless of it is or is not, they think it's safer. And so, you know, you have the timid cyclists, you have the timid dads and moms with the burlies on the back. And so once the perception is there that it's going to be safer, then that will ultimately lead to increased use. And what we do know is that increased use leads to increased safer environments. That is, there's increased safety through numbers. So, unfortunately, these separated facilities come at a large price tag. But nonetheless, there is evidence to suggest that they have an effect with respect to perception. The second is, I don't know if anyone read the New York Times book review this past week, but there was a review by David Byrne about the recent book that was just recently published, I think 3 months ago, by Jeff Mapes. I forget the title, but it's about how cycling culture is taking over America. And from what I've only read chapters 1 and 2 so far, but it's very good. I think I can say that I highly encourage it to anyone. But David Byrne reviewed the book. He was very congratulatory about it. But what he says is that what we need is prominent people, like Carl was mentioning this morning, out there riding bikes, not for racing-related purposes. I mean, what we're seeing right now is what I'm claiming to be the Lance Armstrong effect. It's 5 years after the fact, and we're enjoying the fruits of his labor, primarily for racing-related endeavors that are slowly creeping into utilitarian-related endeavors. But what Dave Byrne says is that we really need good-looking women in skirts wearing Dutch bikes in Manhattan. And when we get there, then we will have no known we've arrived. So there are some pictures of Jennifer Aniston out there. She's not wearing a skirt on a Dutch-type bike, and so we need to promote that type of image, and so subsequently good things will follow.
Okay.
Oh, I was just, this is Corinne Winter with the Silicon Valley Bicycle Coalition. I was going to first recognize Carrie for all the efforts she's done, because I know probably a little bit more than the other panelists about her particular situation at Moffitt Business Park in Sunnyvale, and I think you're already doing a lot of it, and that there's a certain number of things that just take time. You know, you're already hosting events, you're already really involved with promoting it with Bike to Work Day, other rides that you do, getting people out. But I actually think that what Kevin was just saying is true, that maybe finding some sort of utilitarian cycling ambassadors at the business park to wear short skirts would help quite a bit. and also, I think in your environment right now, we've come a long way in terms of promoting cycling with CEO messaging and things like that, but it has been more of the racer sort of identity, and so maybe shifting a little bit more of that focus into creating some heroes, putting information up on your internal websites, things like that about the great people who aren't that type of cyclist, who are more of a utilitarian cyclist, will inspire others to follow suit.
Yeah, but Corinne, my point wasn't that we need women in skirts riding bicycles. That's not the seductive element. It's the fact that we need good-looking women wearing skirts that may be long and flowing to show the versatility that it can actually be done.
Or they could be skorts, right, for ease of bicycle riding.
Shirley Johnson, I just wanted to add a comment. You asked how to get over the hurdle of the negative perception, and I wanted to echo what these folks said about getting the word out there. When I go on business trips, the first thing I say to where I'm going is, how can I get from the airport to your plant by public transportation? And the answer I get inevitably is, it's impossible. So I go to the website, and I have to do a lot of digging, but I can find a bus from the airport to almost anywhere. And it's very difficult, though. A lot of these transit systems are not connected. So you have to go to one website, then you have to try to find another website, and you have to try to find connections. And a lot of people, that is the hurdle. It's just the barrier of getting the information. It's very difficult. So I don't know who in this room could comment on that, but if everybody could please connect their transit website so it's really easy to get around, that would help a lot.
Mark?
Mark Simon from Caltrain and Samtrans. You know, it's been interesting because through our partnership, we operate Caltrain. We're the managing agency. And then we also run the bus service in San Mateo County. And it's interesting because I guess nobody's ever asked for a toy bus set for Christmas. And so there's just a certain amount of cachet and attention and excitement that trains generate that are not the same as buses. There's actually an Irish punk band that has a song called Only Losers Ride the Bus. I don't think that's really the case, but I think that is a lot of people think that the bus, a lot of people believe in mass transit and they believe someone else should use it. And so I think one of the things we have to do is, and you're seeing this at VTA with its 22 BRT system. It's phenomenally successful in an economic downturn. Their ridership continues to go up. Around here, it's true that it should be faster. I don't know if it has to be cheaper. It just has to be cheap enough. The prime commodity for people in this area is not money, it's time. And if you can get them where they want to go, when they want to go there in a timely way, people will flock to it. And the proof of that is, in 2005, Caltrain doubled the number of express trains we were running. Our ridership is up more than 50%. Our revenues are up more than 100%. Tragically, that doesn't solve our structural deficit. But it certainly indicates that it's the time that people find appealing. I also believe, knowing what I know about VTA buses and Samtrans buses, once people get on, they cross a major threshold, that it isn't the experience that they were fearful it was going to be. They're cleaner, they're safer, and they're more comfortable. But you got to get them over that threshold of it's timely, and that's the key.
Okay, we'll take the next question. I'm going to ask the panel. I'll probably let two or three panelists maybe talk for a question so we can get done by noon.
Hi, my name's Jeff Selzer, and I'm actually one of the 1%. So I race my bike, I commute by bike. I'm even probably more like a half of 1/3 of 1% because I make my living in bikes. I manage Palo Alto Bicycles. I also manage the bike station at Palo Alto, which is the bike commuter hub at the Palo Alto station. Here's the question I've got. As I see it, there's two problems that I've got getting people on bikes. One, far and away, the most important is safety. They're afraid. And speaking, I believe it was Kevin, to your point of, you know, there's a certain percentage we don't want to touch. I agree with that. Everybody else, the number one issue they've got is they can't get there safely. Creating an infrastructure that gets people from point A to point B on a bike safe, that will do more to get people on bikes than anything else you do, anything. So first off is how do you get that to happen? Mark, you've mentioned a couple of times the Buck Rogers, you know, the money is the big issue. My understanding is it runs about $25,000 to $60,000 or $70,000 per car parking spot to maintain that, put it in, maintain it. How do we get government to shift their thinking? The $25,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 to park a car is more important than spending $20,000 annually just to stripe some streets. I'm challenged with societies have a tendency to honor what their government, you know, honors. And if we're going to tell them this is where we're going to spend the money and this is what we think is important, I think that's where they're going to expect that money to be spent. So how do we make that shift in, on the government level? Thanks.
John?
Hey, Jeff. Those are good points, and it's kind of the perennial challenge if you go back to my notion that, you know, 2% of people ride bikes and the other 98% don't, and then maybe you add transit users. The fact is, in the San Francisco Bay Area, except for a few dense spots, we're a car-oriented community, so that's why the question you pose is so challenging, because the majority of people right now want to drive everywhere they go, and I'm saying this with tongue firmly planted in cheek, we in Leiden's view, you know, I'm joking, have another idea that, well, maybe transit and biking and walking are good. So how do we persuade our electeds to make those decisions? Well, it's not easy, but we're in the minority. That makes it hard, but she who cries loudest is heard first. And so to me, it's mobilizing and communicating with the decision makers. And you ask any elected, they'll tell you, I'm going to listen first to the people who contact me. They're not, you know, they only have so much time in the day. So I don't have the solution, but part of it is mobilizing people with our same vision and communicating that vision to electeds.
I'm going to go to the next question. Go ahead.
John Ciccarelli, Bicycle Solutions, Planning, Infrastructure, and Education Consultant. First, regarding the ABC cyclist categorization that's been around for many decades, the differentiating factor there is not necessarily fear, but understanding of how traffic works. A, cyclists understand how bikes work in traffic and how traffic works around bikes. B, cyclists are adults who understand driving from a car perspective, but don't understand how to apply that to bikes. C, cyclists are children which lack both the car driving understanding and the bike driving understanding. By far, the most effective way to turn a B cyclist into an A cyclist, and it can happen in 10 hours, is to educate them. And there are several of us in the on the panel and on the audience here who are cycling educators. Bicycle driver education instruction is one of those things that's on the cusp. And I would urge, I would wonder what each agency, I know John Brazil's answer, I know Corinne's answer, are doing to bring education up to the first class consideration for changing the cycling culture. So that's a question. And then regarding transit infrastructure, I have two questions that I'll say and then listen for my answers offline. I think it's time to think about standardizing the onboard space for folders, folding bikes, and folding implements like scooters, because we can dramatically increase the capacity without adding more full-size bike space. There are many people bringing on folders on board like myself. I ride a Brompton. That could store their bike twice or three times as densely if a space were provided specifically for that purpose. And lastly, I'll close with a more of a blue sky concept. Mark, you mentioned, why do we have this cachet associated with trains and the crossways commute issue? You know, we don't have train lines that go east-west around here. Has there been thought given to combining express buses, especially on routes like the Monterey Highway route or the Half Moon Bay route, with high-capacity bike trailers. So you have one bike space per seat, and yet express stops. You don't have to stop every local walking stop for a pedestrian to let a bike get off this high-capacity device. Every 2 miles would be fine. So basically a bus that approximates a train with one bike space per seat.
Okay. Mark, you go first.
Yeah, that's Mark Simons. An interesting idea. There are no shortage of good ideas. The question is, which ones do you do first, and how do you pay for them, and all the other stuff. And it's the same dilemma. I think we all want to do as much as we can, and we're just limited by either the physical constraints of our service and system or by budgetary constraints. On that note, I have to leave early. I apologize. I have another meeting I have to go to. I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to be here. I'm mostly talking to the audience here because I suspect the radio audience doesn't really care if I've left early or not. But in any event, thank you for the chance to be here.
Anybody else?
I've got to take this.
Sean?
John, just in part of your bike education, which is, of course, a big component of the perception of safety, I was just having this discussion this morning about driver education, and the DMV driver handbook is in California is undergoing some changes in order to sort of integrate more bicycles in there, and there's been talk of making it not necessarily a car driver handbook, but an operator handbook. So I think that there could be more effort done at the state level to educate not just about driving your car, but how bikes on the road and how you should act as a bike operator as well.
Okay, next question.
My name is Michelle DeRobertis with the Valley Transportation Authority, and my question pertains to the chronic funding shortfall we have for bicycle and pedestrian facilities in our county, state, and nation. So just to make it simple, would each of you support a dedicated gas tax for bicycle and pedestrian facilities that could fund infrastructure, including access to transit infrastructure, and it could be modeled after the existing TDA return to source funding of gas tax that we already have, so it would be really easy to implement, and our esteemed moderator could chime in if he cares to. If my calculations are correct, a simple 1 cent per gallon gas tax could return to Santa Clara County alone $10 million a year, and I don't think any of us would even notice a 1 cent per gallon gas tax. That would be a lot of money. Do I hear some support?
I think you get a lot of people in the transportation industry who support a gas tax. The problem is the voters out there. I believe the MTC has had on the books for the last 10 years the ability to put up to a 10 cent a gallon gasoline tax in the ballot, but every time they take a survey, it's in the, 30%, John?
Yeah, it just doesn't pull well.
I think we should pull 1 cent per gallon dedicated to bike and pedestrians. They've never done that particular poll.
Alex?
Yeah, I think, you know, it hasn't been adjusted for inflation, and that's a big problem. That's part of the reason, you know, along with more efficient vehicles, that we have the Highway Trust Fund is going bankrupt and needs to find a new funding solution. But that is something that's very active in the reauthorization discussions and will continue. You know, how can we better fund highways in general, including transit, and the mass highway transit and transit accounts. So I'm not sure exactly what they're going to come up with, but certainly raising the fuel tax could be part of the solution, or adjusting it for inflation rather than just tacking another cent on.
Corinne?
Corinne Winter. I think this is really the crux of the issue is funding, and it's currently not looking good, obviously, in the current economic climate. But you know, whether you're talking about programs for education to generate awareness, staff time to revise the driver's handbook, all of it is taking funding, and that has to come from somewhere, or the actual infrastructure improvements, which we all know are quite a bit more expensive. Another interesting thing to watch, especially here in Santa Clara County, will be the HOV lane ideas. Bicycle and pedestrian activists should probably try and pay attention to this and make sure that the funding allows for being recycled back into bicycle pedestrian improvements in that transit corridor. Santa Clara County in particular is looking at the possibility of having a lot of those funds get recycled Bay Area wide, and so that's a concern a lot of people have brought up with possible legislation happening on that front.
Gary, I'm sorry, I can't help but to point to, and this speaks to your point as well, Jeff, We're in California, the land of Don Shoup, and there's Shoupistas, I'm sure, in this room here. But you looked at the success story of Pasadena with charging their Auden Street parking and then translating, recirculating that back into community investments, which could be bicycle-related as well, is a real valuable opportunity.
Okay, next.
Yeah, John Carpenter. I live in Mountain View. For the past several years, I've been surveying the Stevens bicycle traffic and Stevens Gate Trail right near where it goes under the 101 freeway. And I pick a midweek day for consistency, and I pick the morning commute hour, and I do it for about an hour and 15 minutes in the year 2000. One, there's a, or thereabouts, I counted about 35 bicycles in an hour and 15 minutes. This last time, a couple of weeks ago, I counted 131 bicycles in the same amount of time. What has happened is that the Stevens Creek Trail has been lengthened in that time. Stevens Creek Trail has allowed bicycles to overcome all kinds of barriers, additional barriers like freeways, like the creek itself, like the Caltrain tracks in that period of time. Right now, the Stevens Creek Trail provides a nonstop, fully graded, just about fully graded, soon to be fully graded access between southwest corner of Mountain View to, and the shoreline area. And coupled... And that is what has produced the increased traffic. There was a, it's just that there's a decrease in barriers, improvement in safety, and so forth. And another side effect is with the completion of the Mary Street Bridge across 280, the trip between, door-to-door trip between Mountain View and the end of college can be accomplished in about 40 minutes, which is fairly competitive with a car, simply because you would have to park a car and walk from a car. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that if you remove barriers, you can increase bicycle traffic. Another thing that I might want to point out is that the secret to the European 40% bicycle usage is, along with the superior transit service, the secret to that is an aggressive fuel tax. Yeah. Always adjustable to inflation. So,
okay. Thank you, John. Next.
Andrew Castile, Bay Area Bicycle Coalition. I wish that Mark was here still, because I wanted to thank him for the ride that I got today down on Caltrain. I got on the 22nd Street station, which is often a gamble when you're a bicyclist, because everybody gets on at fourth with their bikes. But the train had two bike cars, which is part of their new effort to get two bike cars on a lot of the rush hour trains. And I noticed another piece was that it took a lot less time to board, because we had two options for boarding. So perhaps there's some, I was going to recommend to him that there are some solutions within added capacity that also reduce dwell time. The other thing I was going to comment on is one of the benefits of bicycling that, and we heard many from the panelists, but one that I didn't hear was the consistency that it provides. I like to use my bike to connect to transit because I know exactly how long that will take. I don't have to meet another transit operator at a certain time. Sometimes those schedules are and aren't connected and synced up well. And so that consistency is an important part of biking. And last, the question for the panelists is, getting people from that bicyclist type B to bicyclist type A, getting them past like that othering where bikes are, you're either a biker or you're not. I feel that one of the better ways of getting that across is to have ciclovia type activities. That's what they have Sunday streets in San Francisco, where they close off some streets and have people re-envision them as just places for people to walk and bike and to use for other things than driving. I was curious if there were other efforts in the area that you know of or in the nation that are trying to close off some of the pedestrian space or the car space for pedestrians and bikes to promote it in that way.
John Brazil, City of San Jose. There's lots of community interest in ciclovia type events, and as you know, San Francisco's started last year and is having more this year. Lots of larger cities are
having Ciclovia type events. For listeners, as you mentioned, it's an event where streets are temporarily opened to pedestrians and bicyclists, which means closed to cars. And it's a great community event. It's not a parade. It's not an art and wine festival, but it's an opportunity to take the streets back and enjoy them in a peaceful manner. So there was a presentation in a national conference last year where the largest cities that have in the U.S. that have adopted this type of program address the logistical challenges, and I'd be happy to refer you to that offline. But I think it's a great idea. There's some budgetary issues that need to be addressed just to operate them, but New York, Chicago, Seattle, Portland, a lot of big cities in San Francisco have done it, so I like it.
Kevin?
Kevin Kreislich. I currently live, like I mentioned, in Boulder, and which probably has the highest per capita of professional cyclists, professional triathletes of any community in the country, other than maybe some of these smaller California communities. And I hesitate to point to Boulder as an example community because there's so many abnormalities about Boulder. I mean, it's often said if you want directions to Boulder, you take this road to the end of reality and then you take a left, which I have to say is true. But the whole endeavor of trying to convert type B cyclists into type A cyclists, I'm not sure that that's a productive endeavor. And as I look around Boulder, there's a lot of type A cyclists, but the reason that Boulder has achieved its level of status, which is now platinum, is not because of them. It's because of the type B cyclists that have no interest in becoming a type A cyclist, and those type B cyclists have been catered to by Boulder through redundancy. In other words, there's a lot of talk about in the cycling world about putting a paint stripe down in the road or building an additional facility. Somehow in Boulder, they've been able to create both because there's different types of users. It's not an either-or type issue. There's always going to be type B commuters, and they're only going to want those types of facilities primarily. So I don't think that that's necessarily a productive endeavor to try and convert the B's to the A's.
Okay, next.
I'm Jeffrey Oldham. I ride Caltrain, VTA light rail, and my bicycle to get to work in Mountain View, where I work at Google. Shirley raised an interesting question, which is the information question. How do I get the information about where to ride my bicycle in the first and last mile, plus connections with the public transportation system? She phrased it in the sense of public transportation agencies, information sites don't play nicely with each other. So I was very briefly involved in Google Transit, and actually Google Transit has partially solved this problem. They have a website, and you can go there, and you get public transportation information for agencies that choose to participate. Now, there's a large technical effort to get this done, but it turns out the largest difficulty in the Google Transit world is getting public transportation agencies to make their information available. They can make that information available for free. Google Transit has made an API available for free that has set a standard in the public transportation world, and I would encourage public transportation agencies to use that. And once that information is available electronically, any company can use that information, whether they want to compete with Google Transit or put it on tweet, this sort of thing. So here's my question for the panelists. So to help solve the first and last mile problem, how do we encourage public transportation agencies to make their routes and schedules available electronically? And how do we encourage cities and counties to make their bicycle information available electronically so that companies such as Google and other companies can make this information available to commuters?
Sean?
Sean Coe, just real briefly. We have on our website 511.org and the phone line, we have a Take Transit Planner, which Google gets a lot of the information from. You can put in your origin and your destination, and it'll tell you how to get there by transit. We also have a bike mapper online, which is it's up now, but it's going undergoing a lot of improvements, which will work in the same way. You put in your origin destination, and it'll tell you, recommend a route for you to get there.
Are those two integrated with each other?
The bike mapper will be integrated with the Take Transit, but not right now.
Okay, thank you. If we go real quick, we can get both questions in.
Okay, I'll try to be fast. I'm Nathan Landau. I'm a planner for AC Transit in the East Bay. We're a bus-only agency. We're trying to encourage more people to ride bikes to the system. I guess I would just there's a lot I'd love to talk about. But what I'll focus on is the question of stigma and connection. And to some extent, we're hoping cyclists will help get out the word about transit. And I think that's happened to some extent. But, you know, what I'm aware of is that the research says people want fast, frequent, and reliable service, and cost is a secondary issue. And a lot of our services do have stigma, and some of that is about who rides them. Our trans-based service over to San Francisco doesn't seem to. But I guess in all of transit planning and certainly in developing the bike-to-transit connection, about 60% of Bay Area, a little more Bay Area transit trips are taken by bus. So while it's great to link up to Caltrain, you want to build a mass system, you need to link up to the bus system as well.
Okay, final question.
I'm Bob Berry. I just wanted to say that I see real problems for transit agencies trying to handle masses of bicyclists taking their bicycle with them. I think if, you know, there's an adequate network of secure bike parking and people know about it, the transit agencies to try and sell people have two bicycles, one to go between home and transit, the other between transit and work. I think that's, you know, on a long run better than trying to accommodate lots of bicycles on mass systems.
Shirley Johnson. Yes. I agree that that will work for some people. That's great. But for someone like me and 40% of the cyclists who ride Caltrain, they vary their normal commute pattern. So I get on at 4th and King in the morning. Yeah. When I come home, I get off at 22nd Street. So I would have to have bikes, and I would have to reshuffle bikes. And I go to meetings in Palo Alto. I go to meetings in Menlo Park. It really works for some people, and that's great, but it won't work for everyone.
Well, it doesn't really work now because there's not a good network of bike parking. But to get a lot of B people to use it if that existed. And the A people, I think, would do the same, would do what you do now.
I agree with you. We need that as well.
Okay, we're going to thank the Mineta Institute for hosting this event, thank our panelists for being here, and I've always wanted to do this.
Oh, okay. I live in Berkeley. Trains running on time. Yeah.